Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. The Unclaimed Property Division is holding unclaimed funds from utility bills, uncashed paychecks, savings accounts, and more. To see if you have unclaimed money, you can visit findmassmoney.gov.
DCU is proud to sponsor this conversation from Boston Public Radio. More at dcu.org.
Germany wants to stop using Russian natural gas, so it's building terminals to hold liquefied natural gas imported from the West. Problem is, that kind of infrastructure is expensive and built to last for decades, which means it could push Germany away from its own green energy targets. Supporters see it as a quick fix to an urgent problem. Others call it moral and economic madness. It's on the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on GBH News 89.7.
One teenager in India sued when her high school banned the hijab, and her case went to India's Supreme Court. I want to wear my hijab and get an education. I don't want to have to choose. How that verdict could redefine secularism in the world's largest democracy. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4, here on GBH News 89.7.
I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it. So last night on CNN's Anderson Cooper, longtime multi-presidential advisor David Gergen said this about the next presidential election.
We have an election coming up in 2024 in which it's very possible that we will have Donald Trump facing off against Joe Biden. If one of those people wins the presidency, he will be governing while he's 80 in his 80-year of age. We've never seen anything like that before, and frankly, I think it's a real risk.
So do I. So we do have age requirements for politicians before you get all upset out there. 25 years or older to be a rep, 30 years or older to be a senator, and you've got to be at least 35 to run for president. So you've got to be old enough. But with most of our top politicians pushing 80 or 90 and saying they'll run again, is it ever time to say enough with the oldsters? We want to hear from you, acknowledging the obvious ageism risk here. We know we're going to be savage for that. If you're mentally fit, you're mentally fit. But should there be a cutoff? Should the leadership of both parties actually reflect the age of their constituents? Give us a buzz or a text at 877-301-8970. You can email us at bprwgbh.org or tweet us at BOS Public Radio. I'm so glad David said this. By the way, he's going to be with us in a couple of weeks. He's got a new book.
Yeah, he's got a great book, by the way. It's called Hearts Touch with Fire, How Great Leaders Are Made, and it's a wonderful book.
You know, my concern is, I mean, he seems to be speaking. You saw the interview. I didn't.
Yeah.
He seems to be talking about the risk is there's an issue of, you know, fitness to think and act and that sort of thing. My concern, believe it or not, is that, but something else even more. I mean, for example, the Democrats are worried. Why isn't our message resonating? Because the message deliverers are all octogenarians. Nancy Pelosi is the greatest speaker who ever lived. She's in her 80s. Her number two, Hoyer, is in his 80s. Jim Clyburn, I love him, and is in his 80s. Joe Biden is 79. Donald Trump is going to, what's Donald Trump going to be, 74 or something like that?
I think he's older than that.
Let's say with the Democrats, it's hard when the face of your party is in their 80s. It's pretty hard to connect. I know someone's going to call and say, well, Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is an aberration. There's almost nobody in the age bracket of Bernie Sanders who's had that kind of appeal to young and middle-aged voters in this country. It almost never happens. And Grassley's running for re-election. How old is he, the Republican from 88?
I think he might be 88. And I mentioned to you before, Jim, there was this really sad piece about Dianne Feinstein, who's been the senator from California for many years and has had a great career. She is also 88. And the people around her realize that she's not lost a step or two, but lost multiple steps and can't remember conversations and repeats questions. We saw her in some of the hearings repeat the exact same question twice. And she's just lost her husband, and he might have been the person to tell her to step down, or maybe her kids. But she's refusing to acknowledge the level of fastballness, if you want to put it that way, that she's lost. The thing about Gergen is
fastballicity is the word.
Fastballicity. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
the thing about Gergen is he said last night, you know, he says, I'm 80 and I know I am not what I was when I was 60 or something like that. And Anderson Cooper says, well, I'm 55 and I'm not what I was when I was 40. I mean, you know, you're not. And certainly you feel that physically, but you also feel that mentally. We all know that in our own lives or in our parents' lives or grandparents' lives and stuff like that. It's kind of ridiculous that these people, including Nancy Pelosi, no matter what a great speaker she's been, can't give up power. But look what happened to Seth Moulton when he launched this crusade to get the leadership passed down. I mean, I think he perhaps thought he was in contention. He's a congressman, of course, from the North Shore. He was totally pummeled, and particularly by women who were very ticked off that he would dare challenge her leadership. So it's a touchy subject for lots of people. It's kind of like, remember we used to talk about trying to get the car keys away from Grandma?
I was just about to bring it up.
Yeah, and you knew that Grandma should not be driving, and you knew that it could be a tragedy if Grandma were to hit somebody or have some kind of accident. But she didn't realize how bad off she was. And that's kind of like what you think about some of these politicians.
By the way, in terms of driving, if we could just include this in the conversation, our position, which caused the ARP, excuse me, of New England to refer to us as terrorists, they literally did in their newsletter.
Yep.
Our position is not that older people over 75, whatever, shouldn't drive. Our position is they have to take a road test.
Road test.
Here's a quiz for people. If you pass your road test at 16, you can answer this question, Marjorie.
Yep.
And you're 116 and you're still driving. How many road tests have you taken in Massachusetts since you turned 16?
You don't take any more ever.
None.
Ever. Ever. You could be 98 and driving around. Nobody's going to give you.
So we can throw that into the mix too.
Yeah. Anyway, I think it's a great point, and I was so glad Gergen gave it because he's somebody I have huge amounts of respect for, and he's been the advisor to all sorts of presidents,
Republicans and Democrats.
Republicans and Democrats. So let's start with Eric in Providence. Eric, what do you think?
Hey, Eric.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in line with the idea of the road test, but I think it's even more glaring. Like, you know, there are things like standard retirement ages for Social Security,
yep,
Medicare, where it's kind of this tacit admission on the part of our government and government institutions to say, look, this person's, you know, read from a particular perspective, past their prime and should be put out to pasture. And now they get all these benefits. So it's insane to me that all these folks would be like, let me take on supposedly what's a really difficult job of like governing and like doing all these things and working super long hours. And they're like 20 years past these, you know, established points in time where as a society, we've been like, yeah, that person, you know, they put in their time. Now we should just take care of them as a society. Instead, these people are like, let me go do the hardest job or one of the hardest jobs there is.
Well, that's a very good point, too, by the way.
That was exactly what Gergen was saying, that when you are the president of the United States, you're the most powerful person on earth. Can you imagine the stress? I mean, you watch how all these presidents age, incredibly, with the exception of Donald Trump. He doesn't look much older than he did when he started. But you look at how Barack Obama aged, how George W. Bush aged, how Biden has aged. Imagine. I mean, you got a lot going on there when you hear about all the terrorism threats and the national security. I think it is an extremely tough job.
And, Eric, thanks.
And that was Gergen's point. This is not the kind of job. And by the way, a lot of people are not giving up their jobs when they're 65. You know why? Because, of course, they can't afford it anymore, right?
So, but there's a difference, by the way, I should say. A 65-year-old worker doesn't have responsibility for, like, all the people in the country. I mean, it's a little bit different. I mean, we can have a discussion on another day about should there be a mandatory retirement age in the private sector workforce or the public sector workforce. I don't think so, but this is a different kind of animal. But by the way, let me just – Caitlin from Providence texts and says, if a doctor is able to declare them mentally fit, fine. But seeing Feinstein's documented mental decline over the last few years and Trump's – this is her speaking, not me – Trump's fairly obvious dementia, at some point we have to say enough is enough. Caitlin, with all due respect, no, we don't. Because the difference is if Jane Doe is declared mentally fit at 88, And she runs and she wins. And at 89, she isn't anymore. There's nothing you can do about it. It's not like a worker, as I said a minute ago. It's somebody who's elected to 6 years or 4 years or whatever. Enough is enough. I mean, but again, I don't just want to focus on competence. I hope people are going to focus on the other issue I mentioned, which is it's ridiculous. You can, again, this is not an anti-Nancy Pelosi thing. I accept, particularly if you see the great frontline piece, arguably the greatest speaker in the history of the speakership. But all three of the Democratic leaders are in their 80s. I mean, really? Anna in Shrewsbury, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
So I just have three quick thoughts.
Please.
Number one, we've seen the people that surround these people in power will not have the guts to speak up when things aren't going well. So that's nerve-wracking. And I think you know, pilots are forced to retire at age 65 for a reason. My personal feeling is there should be a cutoff as to when you can run for president or a higher office. And I don't quite know what that is, but I'm thinking like 65, 70. Because, you know, I'm not an ageist. I think elderly people are very capable of many, many things. But I'll tell you, you were talking about elderly drivers. My husband's a physician, and I can't tell you how many unsafe people are on the road. We don't monitor that. So I just think if you got a guy with his finger on the nuclear button, that's like a big job, and that should be regulated.
Those are great points. You know, remember when we used to do the stories about how you should have to take a road test, Jim?
Yeah.
There was a study at BU about aging and driving and reflexes and speed of reflexes and stuff like that. There was the guy there at BU was talking about how a huge percentage of people by their 80s
early onset dementia.
Yes.
Well, it's not early at that point, yeah.
Yeah, I think he was 85. So that's Feinstein and Chuck Grassley are over the top there. But it is incredible, Bernie Sanders. So he is somebody, and there's a difference. I mean, we all know that in our own lives, too. Some of your grandparents, I mean, a good friend of mine, her mother is in her late 90s. For some reason, her hair has not gone gray, and she's not lost her hearing, and she's frail, but she's not lost her fastball.
But
that's unusual.
You're missing the point, if I may. I'll give you another example. You watched the basketball game the other night.
Yes.
You know who the color commentator was?
I don't know. I saw Charles Barkley commentate.
Hubie somebody. I can't think of his last name. He used to be a coach in the NBA. He was spectacular. How old he is?
I have no idea.
88.
Really?
And he was great. The issue is not, are some people competent at 88? Of course, a huge percentage of people are competent at 80 or 88. The issue is, as David Gergen says, and frankly, I think it's a real risk. It is a real risk that there can be pretty rapid decline pretty quickly.
Well, didn't Biden talk about just running for one term at some point when he was running for office?
Yeah, but he's talked about running for re-election now kind of thing.
But I don't think he is going to run for re-election.
I think
that's part of he doesn't want to be a lame duck thing and lose all his power. I don't think he has any intention of running for election. He certainly shouldn't run for re-election.
And by the way, on the car thing, if people are offended, we've told this story before. This was recounted to us by the late Brian Joyce, who was one of the few state senators who had the courage to bring up this issue about testing older drivers. It was Plymouth or somewhere. An older gentleman was driving, and understandably, he got stuck in a snowdrift. And he got stuck in a snowdrift, and he called the police, as any of us would, to help him out.
The Cape.
And it turned out the only problem was when the 911 people answered, they said, "Snowdrift, it's August." And he wasn't in a snowdrift. He was in a sand trap.
He was in a sand trap.
So there's a point at which maybe he should have taken a road test, is what I sort of think.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of very sad stories about people. It tends to be the same thing, where people think they're going forwards when they're going backwards, or they think they're going backwards when they're going forwards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the average person would immediately notice that they were not going the direction that they thought they were in. But that's one of the problems when you get to a certain age where you have these problems, is that you seem to be confused about which direction you're heading. Lori from Halifax, thank you for calling.
I think the rule of thumb should be, if you don't know what direction you're heading in, it's probably time
to hang it up. And the beauty of this is, by the way, is that if there's a law, then you don't have to get into a hassle with
your
parents or your grandparents.
You're
and they hate you for taking away their car keys. And in defense of people who hate having their car keys taken away, it's because often you're stranded. You're out in the middle, you know, you're 5 miles from the CVS.
Well, that's where the government's got to step in and provide transportation for older people.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Lori from Halifax, thank you for calling.
What's up?
Hi. I've called in a couple times. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep, perfectly.
Okay. I think there should be a mandatory cognitive test on all government levels at certain ages. But what I really wanted to say was that I think we should establish, the Democrats in particular, because I am one, but a mentor program where people like Pelosi or Bernie Sanders are, you know, going to mentor the younger generation and bring them up and teach them how to do the stuff that obviously comes with, you know, having the job for 100 years, and then bring up the next generation of Democrats. I don't understand why we just sort of keep running and running and running and never bring anyone up from, you know, bring them up.
Well, Lori, let me just give you an example of where Pelosi has done that. Most people think that the person she is mentoring big time is a local woman, Catherine Clark, who is now the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House. And she's a woman, obviously, and I think she's in her 50s. The problem is she made a decision, Nancy Pelosi, to not let her into the top three. And the top three who do most of the talking, Hoyer, Clyburn, and Pelosi, are all in their 80s, and I think that's a pretty hard sell, don't you?
Then she's not mentoring anybody.
Well, that's a good point.
Still trying to keep power.
That's a good point.
Lori, thank you. You know, Jim, correct me if I'm wrong.
Please.
The Republicans do it differently. It's not all about seniority.
That's chairs.
Leadership.
That's chairs of committees. It's not automatic. Well, the Democrats, by the way, if for whatever it's worth, Dianne Feinstein was supposed to be the chair of the Judiciary Committee yet again, and Chuck Schumer talked her out of it. And then there was a contest between White House from Rhode Island, who's pretty regularly on our show, and Durbin from Illinois. And Durbin won that race. You know what?
Chuck Schumer talk her out of it? Because I think he was embarrassed about her previous performance.
But let me just say one thing. I'm trying to come up with, you know, if people aren't happy with a firm age and you're out kind of thing, how about this? Is that every politician over a certain age has to take a driver's test. And if they end up in a sand trap and think they're in a snowbank, can we all agree, Republicans and Democrats together, that it is time to
Well, you know, I don't mean to be depress people, but among the saddest stories I ever did when I was a reporter was interviewing a woman who actually had killed people.
Driving in the doctor's office,
yes.
Right? I remember that.
And I remember this poor woman, I mean, obviously she killed people, and that was horrible. But she didn't really understand what had happened or why it happened. I don't even think she could recall that it happened. It was a real, and her lawyer agreed with me. It was really horrible that this woman was still driving a car. Anyway, we're talking about whether you should give it up when you hit 80. When should people get out of there in politics? Should there be an age limit on judges, as there is on most judges, not on the Supreme Court, unfortunately, but for most other judges? Should there be age limits? Our number is 877-301-8970. You can call us or text us at that number, or you can email us at bpr@wgbh.org or tweet us at Boss Public Radio. You're listening to 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're asking about instituting essentially upper age limits or some such thing on politicians. I have to say, we've mentioned this in passing before. I haven't had the courage to bring it up as a topic because we usually get bombarded with ageist, you're sending these people out to pasture kind of thing. But when somebody as respected as David Gergen says it to Anderson Cooper,
who's 80 himself,
last night, again, an advisor to at least four presidents, Democrats and Republicans, I think you have to take heed, and I am totally with him. You can give us a call or a text at 877-301-8970. I was just during the break was also reading all a lot of texts, reading them, and I have to say the tone of this has changed. Generally, I would say 60 to 70% of the feedback on this, when we've talked about in the past, has been very negative and critical of us. That's not the case now. And maybe it's because the two front runners for the presidential nominations in 2024 are both pretty old guys, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, no?
that could be. And I think there is some concern. Joe Biden has been a gaffe machine all his life. I mean, he's never spoken well. Everybody knows he had that stutter as a child. I think that's part of it. But I think you look at him now and you do wonder.
He's aging.
He's aging and he's had difficulty lots of times putting his words together. But, you know, something, so do I. So the
well, you're not president of the United States,
Marjorie. One of the texters says, wondering what age radio commentators should begin cognitive tests. And I think, Jim, there are certain days where I am quite confused. Don't know where I am. Don't know why I'm here. I mean, maybe we should have them here at GBH, don't you think?
Remember when Vincent Gardenia said to Olympia Dukakis, he gets home, she thinks he's having a affair. This is in the great movie Moonstruck. She says, where have you been? And he turns to her and says, I don't know where I've been. I don't know where I'm going. I'll say no more.
Exactly.
Anne from Lincoln, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Good topic. I have 2 points. One is that I believe the definition of a baby boomer is somebody born 1945 onward.
Is it?
And the people
we're talking about 45 to 65.
These people are the pre-baby boomer generation.
Good point.
They were born before that. You know, they've been blockading all the positions for the boomers, let alone the generations after that. But the bigger point I want to make is I've been so impressed with all of the Ukrainian politicians on television in the last 2 months. These people, they're like parliamentary people, mayors, of course, Zelensky, his aides. They're all, I think, under the age of like 50.
But you are brilliant.
That's a great point.
You are totally right, Anne.
Yeah.
Aren't they wonderful people, you know, and I mean, what is this thing we have that somebody has to be a senior citizen to be a politician in office nowadays? I don't get it. And you know, the founding fathers, when they wrote the Constitution, they were all pretty young men.
Yep,
you know,
that's a great point, too.
Benjamin Franklin was by far the oldest person in the room. And even Washington was fairly young compared to our group that we have in office now. So
Benjamin Franklin, if he was alive, would probably be running for president, man. I mean, why not? And thank you for the call. We appreciate it. That was great.
Have you noticed Michelle Wu, who's 36 years old, who's the mayor of Boston? What is the thing you most note about the people she's got around her?
Young.
They're all young, and it's so different than what we're used to seeing here in Boston. I mean, Marty Walsh was not very old himself. I think he was in his 50s when he was the mayor.
I think so, yeah.
But she is, you know, a good 15 or years younger at least, and you notice a big difference. And you do notice these people that are on television, these young women in Ukraine, they look to be, you know, 35. Anyway, 877-301-8970 is the number at which you can call or text. Laura from Sharon, hi.
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 Long time, first time.
Ooh, my God. Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Oh, great. So I was calling because I'm a clinical neuropsychologist. This is actually what I do for a living.
Oh.
Cognitive assessment, primarily in the elderly, because that's who most often come with these complaints. And your concerns about both leading and driving are 100% valid. Over the age of 85, about 45% of all people have Alzheimer's disease to some degree.
Was it 45%, did you say?
45%
wow.
At 85. And that number never plateaus and it never stops. Every year you get older, that rate increases. By the time you've entered your ninth decade, pretty much everybody has the plaques and tangles that we associate with Alzheimer's disease. Mm. Further, their cognitive reaction times, their problem solving, their cognitive flexibility and shifting, processing speed, memory, all of these things are to a level that would be severely impaired if that individual were assessed against, say, a 50-year-old.
So I guess you think that we shouldn't be electing 80-year-old presidents, Laura. Is that fair to say?
I think, now, as you point out, you know, there is a range.
Yeah.
And there are people who are cognitively intact. However, we can measure this. We can know what a person's, how they are performing relative to their peers and how they're performing relative to younger peers. Because, frankly, the job might require sort of aging that down a bit, given the pressures and the responsibilities associated with it. I remember when Biden and Trump were running against each other, and Hillary was still in the mix. And there was this big discussion of, oh, if only we could, you know, assess these people and figure it out. And I'm like, there is a way.
Yeah, but I mean, the reality is, this notion of making an assessment of a candidate and then having the American people sort of integrate that assessment into their decision, I think it's borderline impossible. There's got to be an age limit. And by the way, somebody just texted and said, your ageism is appalling. I really, really wish you would call, because it is true that almost everybody's agreeing with us. We're not screening out calls. We're just not getting them on your side. Your ageism is appalling. So, Laura, the tests work for medical purposes. I'm not sure they work for political purposes. But that was a great first call, and we hope make another one soon. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Laura. Art Kaplan, who talks to us all the time about medical ethics, he's a big proponent of having medical and mental screenings of candidates for president.
So am I.
And so...
By an independent third party.
Yes.
You know what he told us, which I didn't realize, when we've talked to him about this a lot during the elections, is there was a reporter at the New York Times whose name I can't remember, who was so respected, he became the de facto repository of information on the candidate's health. And then he, I believe I got this right, in a fair and careful way, disclosed information to the public. But there should be an independent authority that gets the full medical records, unlike that. Remember that letter that Trump wrote for his doctor, the hippie doctor, saying he's the healthiest whatever candidate in the history of the world kind of thing, so that the American people know. Having said that, that's sort of Laura's suggestion. I don't see what's wrong with an age limit. And by the way, the notion is not that these people then can't do anything for the rest of their lives. They can do anything they want. They just can't run a country. I think that's a fair position.
A lot of people have texted in or emailed in about run-ins with elderly drivers on the roads. Christopher just informed us that Trump is going to be 76 on June 14th.
So he'd be in his 80s in his next term, should he win. He'd be 78.
And remember,
when he was running for his second term as president. And at the end of that term, he'd be, I don't know what the math is, 82 or 83.
And as we all know, I forget how old Ronald Reagan was in his second term, but we now know that he had Alzheimer's in the last
very good point.
Months of his career. Pam from Amesbury, thank you for calling.
Hi, Pam.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a pet peeve of mine. I just want to say up front, I'm 76. And we used to have age 65, you retired. But for money purposes now, we let people stay, like I did, until I was in my 70s. However, I am so angry about the political situation, and I think one of the big problems is our young people are so turned off by Joe Biden saying, well, we sat at the kitchen table. You know, please, we have major problems here. Make some decisions. You lose your edge in the 70s, much different than when you're in your 60s.
You know, well, Pam, I'm with you on that. I wish you'd stop telling us what his father had to say and what his mother had to say. I mean, it's like, okay, that was a long time ago. But Pam, thank you very much for the call. We are out of time, but up next we're going to be speaking with a Boston Globe business columnist, Shirley Young. Is she next? Have I got this wrong?
She is. No, she is next.
Okay, I wanted to make sure she was next because, you know, maybe I need a test. Every day I can't find the script. I don't know what I'm saying next. So I don't know, Jim. Maybe you should ship me off somewhere.
You want a serious response? I don't want to say it again because we always get that. You could be fired tomorrow. If someone says you're not competent to do your job anymore, the Speaker of the House can't be fired. The President of the United States can't be fired. I mean, they can in the next election.
Yeah.
But it's a whole different kettle of fish. Okay. I know you're trying to be funny, but I'm telling you.
Okay.
There's a serious aspect.
You're not trying to get rid of me, is there? You don't do that, are you, Jim?
Sadly, I don't make that decision.
Okay. As I just said before, up next I'm going to talk to the Boston Globe business columnist, Shirley Young, about a provocative column by one of her colleagues about the hold of the Catholic Church on the Supreme Court vis-a-vis abortion. Very interesting stuff coming up from that Shirley Young column up next.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Joining us now is Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung. Hello there, Shirley.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Shirley. Great to talk to you. So let's start with your colleague Joan Fanaki's column. I love this one. She's basically talking about how the Supreme Court is in the pocket of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. What'd she have to say for herself?
Well, you know, I think a lot of us were wondering that. Where, you know, why aren't we reading all the stories about the Catholic Church dancing in the pew, dancing in the aisles and the pews of the church that Roe v. Wade will be overturned? And I think it was really interesting. Her column on this topic exposed that they want to kind of you know, keep a low profile on it, right? Mm-hmm. They don't want to almost invite controversy. Maybe a lot of, maybe their flock doesn't always agree with them on this issue. And so she was surprised. The reaction has been tepid, even though, the Catholic Church, you know, when Roe v. Wade was, when abortion was first legalized in the early 1973, I think they were against it. And so they fought it.
Well, I think part of the reason, Marjorie, you'd have a better sense than I, is I read two polls this morning. One had 56% of Catholics in the pews support Roe v. Wade. Another one had 68%. So the reality is their flocks, for lack of a better expression, aren't with them.
Well, the flocks aren't with them. The flocks aren't with the bishops on any number of things. As we all say, there are no more 12 children families in the pews of the Catholic Church because the Catholics are all ignoring the bishops about abortion, and because the Catholic Church lost a lot of its moral authority during the pedophilia scandal. But the other thing is that they haven't done, Catholic Church hasn't done what it should have done, is get out and lobby for the Build Back Better bill that would have helped women who can't afford children to afford those children. They haven't done nearly enough to support pregnancies of women who find themselves with an unwanted pregnancy. The Catholic bishops have almost become, some of them anyway, an arm of the Trump side of the Republican Party. I talk about Dolan down in New York State, the cardinal there, New York City, or this crazy quote that Joan has in this column. I didn't even hear about this one, from a Rhode Island priest making headlines when he banned 44 lawmakers from getting communion because they supported abortion rights. And he said it with this quote, "Pedophilia doesn't kill anyone." First of all, there are a lot of suicides that we all know about from people who were victims of the Catholic priests. But, I mean, she talks about the fact that back when JFK ran, the idea was for him to separate himself from the Pope to assure everybody he wasn't taking orders.
He made that famous speech,
the Vatican.
Wasn't it, in Houston or somewhere?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's a legitimate question to ask. What is the influence of the Catholicism of Amy Coney Barrett, who lived in a kind of odd Catholic cult-like housing situation for quite some time, who taught at Notre Dame, which has routinely banned people who are pro-choice from speaking there, including Barack Obama. So I think that it's a legitimate question to ask. Has Catholicism merged too tightly with the United States of America in the form of the United States Supreme Court, the third branch of government? It's a legitimate question.
It is. And, I think I'm actually struck by the pro-life movement. I mean, and maybe it's because of the media market we're in. We actually haven't heard as much from that side. And, you know, when I've been kind of searching for stories, it's interesting what you raised, Marjorie, is that almost the pro-life is side is realizing, wait, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, it's a lot of work for us too. We have to create centers to support women who have unwanted children. And so they themselves have a lot to prepare.
And by the way, Mitch McConnell is vacillating on whether or not if the Republicans take over and there's a Republican president, they'll vote on a national ban on abortion. I assume most people know that the Democrats are forcing a vote in the Senate today on essentially codifying Roe v. Wade. It will fail not just because of the filibuster, but because they can't get 50 votes. Because anybody want to guess which of the Democrats is anti-choice?
Joe Manchin.
So in any case, that'll fail this afternoon, but they essentially want to stake out a position, which I think is the right thing to do. Can we go from that sort of existential issue to the office. Hybrid, you know, it's sort of like a duh kind of thing. I mean,
exactly.
Everybody,
how many surveys do we need?
Exactly. There's a piece that says that the future is hybrid offices. I mean, doesn't everybody, do we have to do that anymore? It's sort of like climate change is real. We don't have to listen to the deniers. They're 99%, well, that's too much. The vast majority of people are never returning to the office full time. A remote work exclusively is probably not going to be the norm. People are going to go to work 2 or 3 days a week and work the other days at home or remotely somewhere. That's it, right?
Yes, and yet, Jim, so many people read that story. They couldn't get enough of it. and maybe they wanted confirmation. Yet, you know, that hybrid workplace is here to stay. It almost seems too good to be true for some people. And there was another study out of Texas, which was really interesting. This was a study that was done not during the pandemic. It was done in 2017. Mm-hmm. It looked at, some traders, the work environment in Houston when a hurricane kept all these workers at home. And they found that productivity did not go down. Though I do have to say one thing was really interesting about the other survey that my colleague John Chester wrote about was the lead of his story about this company called First Light, and which happens to be energy trader, and how the CEO put out a job listing for 2 energy trading jobs I had to be in Boston. She got 0 applications. But then when she said it was remote, she got 30. And a lot of these energy traders are in Houston. And so they didn't want to relocate to Massachusetts. So that has really big implications for, the ability for employers to get talent, but also its implications for downtowns and for the state if we don't have the talented workforce moving into Massachusetts.
You know what? I know this is almost as duh-like as saying that we're going to have hybrid workplaces. The shift in power between the employer and the employee, I'm not suggesting that there's still not an imbalance in the direction of the employer, but the fact that employees, particularly in industries that can't fill positions, have as much bargaining power individually. Forget if they're forming unions, you know, Amazon and Staten Island, we're going to talk about later in the show, the baristas at Starbucks and some other places, Pavement, et cetera. It's amazing how the dynamic has shifted over these past couple of years, Shirley. You see that, I assume, in almost all the businesses you cover, no?
I do. They talk about the tight labor market. They talk about, they were worried about retaining and hiring employees before the pandemic. And now it's much worse. And of course, you know, what happened right now, the economy is relatively strong. That dynamic could change if we go into a recession.
You know, one last thing, which is the fun story about this hybrid / level. I'm not even going to deal with the whole pre-pandemic survey about productivity being the same, because frankly, it may be in some office settings. It's not in all office settings. Power lunch has returned.
Oh, I love this one.
I'm reading a story in the Globe, and I had to check to make sure I was reading right.
Yeah.
Some restaurant is talking about, Kara Baskin wrote this thing, and talking about pent-up hedonism, and that's her phrase.
Madman is back.
And then some people ordering $55 steaks at lunch.
Gin and tonics.
Right? I love it. Cocktails at
noon. So what is that,
noon.
Like $150 a head to go out to lunch? Is that what they're doing now?
Yeah, so she went to some of the hot spots like Abe and Louie's and Contessa, the new rooftop restaurant at Newberry, and she spotted lines. Now I have been out to lunch. I have done the power lunches. The places I have been, they've been packed, but no line out the door. I'm not having martinis at lunch. I'm sticking with the salad and chicken salad. But I can see some of this happening in some of the restaurants, because what's happening is that maybe you haven't seen your colleagues in months or years. And maybe it's that, that once a month lunch where you do, you do drink at lunch, you do eat a nice steak, but I don't think it's I don't think you're doing this every day.
Based on what? I mean, why do you think that?
Because you can't usually come back to work and function very well if you've gone out for a 2 martini lunch.
Most places are hybrid. You're half the time you're at home eating your turkey sandwich. And then the next day you're having your bone-in ribeye, right?
You know, in all seriousness, how come neither of you are reacting to that? Could you spend, if the server came over to you and the most interesting thing on the menu, even if you had an expense account for lunch, is a ribeye for $55, could you bring yourself to say, I'll have the ribeye medium rare for $55 at lunch?
Hey, all bets are off at a power lunch, Jim, with cocktails. You know, Jim, you might need the steak to absorb some of the booze kind of thing. But I'm old enough to remember when these were not that unusual, that your boss would take you out to lunch. And I recall getting sent home after my boss took me out to lunch because I did have a cocktail at lunch and I was, you know, I couldn't come back and work. They used to be, I don't know when they went out of style. Was it during the early 90s that they went out of style?
So essentially the day was you work in the morning, you go to two martini lunch, and then you get sexually harassed in the afternoon. Is that what the day was like?
Or perhaps during lunch. As I recall.
Well, the power lunch is back. Marjorie and I are eating at the Newsfeed Cafe. That's our power lunch most days, I should say.
Okay, Shirley Young, let's talk about this new dean, or chancellor, I should say, up at UMass Lowell, Julie Chen. Tell us about her. She's had quite a career.
This is such exciting news. Julie, on Monday, the UMass Board of Trustees unanimously voted Julie Chen, who's been a longtime administrator, dean at and professor of mechanical engineering at UMass Lowell. She's been there for about 25 years. They named her the next chancellor of UMass Lowell. I believe she's the first Asian American to lead that campus. She's the first openly gay chancellor at a UMass campus. Despite this kind of image that Asian Americans are campuses and are teeming with Asian Americans, there are very few Asian Americans at the administrative level. So she's one of only a handful of Asian Americans who are leading a college or university in Massachusetts right now, and she is incredible. She has 3 degrees from MIT. And my favorite thing about her is her nickname is Nano Queen.
Which means,
so she is one of the region's leading experts in nanotechnology. Yeah.
Whatever that is.
What is nanotechnology, Shirley?
Well, building devices or products from, you know, very tiny, like almost at the atomic level. You know, one, it used to be described as no longer, but like it's smaller than like one thousandth of your hair, like that's small, microscopic, you know, and you build products and devices and chips out of it. And so at one time she was one of 3 women at the UMass Lowell overseeing nanotechnology research. And so these 3 women were nicknamed Nano Queens. but she's incredible. The students love her. It was really, when you look at the other 2 finalists, one from Kentucky, one from Georgia, I mean, there was just no contest. She's just, she is beloved on the campus. And it's so great that she's succeeding Jackie Maloney, who is retiring in this year, and Jackie was the first woman to lead UMass Lowell. So I love the fact that a woman is succeeding a woman.
How is Marty Meehan, who's head of UMass, for those few who don't know, how's he done on the diversity front in terms of his high level appointments?
He's, 3 of the 4 chancellors he's had to appoint were all, I think, people of color. Now we have the 5 campuses of UMass, UMass Boston's Latino. Marty appointed him, now Julie Chen, and then Jackie Maloney was also Marty Meehan's hire. So he's 3 of the 4 chancellors he appointed have been women or people of color. That's a lot of diversity at the UMass level.
So, Shirley, 4, it seems, restaurateurs from, I believe, 4 establishments in the North End
yep.
are paying the $7,500 or maybe on the payment plan and the $400 and some per parking spot that is mandated by the city by Mayor Wu, but are suing Wu for, what, $1.5 million, some amount of money, whatever, yes, for the damage that's done, saying that they're constitutional. Well, what is their argument exactly?
Yeah,
do they have
a case here?
Yeah, what are they saying?
There are a handful of North End restaurants that have been upset about Mayor Wu's rules regarding outdoor dining. And so the North End is the only neighborhood in Boston that has to pay a fee for a temporary outdoor dining permit. I don't know if they have a case. I mean, basically, it's unfair. Why are we being singled out? Why don't restaurant owners on temporary who are petitioned for temporary permits? Why can't they? The restaurants on Beacon Hill, the restaurants in South End, how come they don't have to pay the fee? And the Wu administration has explained that there are a lot of restaurants that have applied for this outdoor permit. Typically, there haven't been that much outdoor dining in North End because it's too, it's too narrow, it's too congested. And so what's happened in the North End is that they have to take over public streets to set up outdoor dining. So the city says it costs us more money, so we want the restaurants to help pay for that. Meantime, as you recall, there was a huge public spat over this. And so the mayor decided, okay, I'm going to create a fund, a hardship fund. Restaurants can apply, for a waiver, some kind of waiver. And a lot of restaurants did.
A waiver based on not just the payment plan, which I think is available to everybody,
yes,
but a waiver if you have a smaller establishment, fewer seats, less patio space, that sort of deal, right?
Right.
So Shirley Young, are we done with this? Because I want to get on to my favorite story of the day. I want to talk about the rhomba for your garden.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it's going to get rid of the weeds. This is one of the most exciting things ever. Tell us about this, because a lot of people use those terrible things, the poisonous weed killers that are really bad for the environment. So tell us about this.
Yeah, so my colleague Hiawatha Bray wrote a delightful piece about Helen Greiner, who is one of the co-founders of iRobot, the Roomba. Most famous product is the Roomba, the vacuum.
Roomba, I said it wrong, sorry.
Roomba, the vacuum cleaner. And
it's so much fun to watch those if you're over at somebody's house for dinner and they put the Roomba on, they demonstrate how it kind of goes back and forth all around the floor. It's really fun.
Anyway, so she left iRobot years ago. She started, a drone company. And now she's created a robot for your garden to pull weeds. And I love the lead of the story where they describe her her home, and then it's got gates, right?
Yeah.
Gates around her property to keep the robots in.
That's right.
It's called the Turtle. It's spelled differently. I think it's pronounced Turtle, but it sounds. I hate pulling weeds from my garden, and so I was thinking, oh, maybe I should get that. But then I was like, do I have to get a gate too? Do I have to fence things off?
Exactly. I don't know. Do you? That's a big question. Maybe going down the street, going to the neighbor's house, right?
Hey, one last thing about this. She was involved in the invention of the vacuum cleaner thing, right? Whatever it's called.
Yes, the Roomba.
Roomba.
And did she leave before the zillions of dollars were made on this thing? What happened exactly?
I mean, she left pretty early on. I don't know if she's, if she cashed out at that point or not. But she seems very successful and become a serial entrepreneur. So I don't know if she retains some money, but I don't know.
This is $349. This machine, solar powered, so you don't have to worry about charging it up. And it sounds like if it doesn't take off down the street, like a revolutionary idea. They talk about these little tiny metal fences that help the turtle differentiate between a weed and a little small seedling.
Sounds like a lot of work building little fences around all the
fences. I think that the little fences are on the machine, right? I'm sorry. You're right, Jim. You have to put them in yourself, but that's not that big of a deal. And it can differentiate between the higher tomato plant, that kind of stuff, and the little plant. So imagine if you could just send this thing out to your garden, Shirley.
No, can I tell you, with all due respect to both of you, the thing that needs improvement is the Flowbee. As we know, the Flowbee is the thing that you attach to a vacuum cleaner, and you can cut your hair with it. And it's one of those as seen on TV things which you buy in the middle of the night. That's what this woman should. What's that?
Why would anybody do that?
Well, I have done it, so that's why. Yeah. I don't know why, but people have done it. So, Shirley, it's
AAPI
month, Heritage Month, and you're doing a panel, I think, today, are you not?
Yeah, tonight at 6 o'clock.
What's the deal?
Boston Globe, and in partnership with the Asian American Journalists Association, we have this terrific panel that we've been working on. It's free. You can RSVP. I think BPR is going to retweet the link. It's called Visibility and Vulnerability of the Asian American Community. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that as we rise, as we become represented, whether it's City Hall or Hollywood, there's also more vulnerability. There's also rising hate crimes and rising hate. And so how do we manage and deal with that duality of Asian Americans?
Who do you have?
We have Tiffany Chu, who's Mayor Wu's chief of staff.
Oh, great.
And, which is great. I've never met her.
And
I don't think a lot of people have heard from her. And she had, moved away from Boston and come back just to work for Mayor Wu. So I'm super excited to have her on the panel. We also have Lawrence Chow, who is an actor and producer who did a film called Justice for Vincent. It's based on the brutal murder of Vincent Chin in 1982 that really sparked an Asian American civil rights movement here and across the country. Actually, Lawrence is known his stardom came first in Singapore, so he's known as the Ryan Seacrest of Singapore. But now he's in LA. And then we also have Ryan Nguyen Win, who is a Dorchester native, Westboro native. He's a Harvard first-year student. And last year, he organized the first major rally to stop Asian hate on the Boston Common. So we have, all these different perspectives, and different generations. So I'm super excited.
So
and everybody is invited.
BOS Public Radio which is the tweet for our show, will tweet out registration or sign up or whatever information. We'll do that. Good luck tonight. Sounds great.
Shirley,
it's good
you.
To see you.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Be well.
That was a Boston Globe columnist, business columnist, Shirley Young. Thank you very much, Shirley, as always, for joining us. Up next, we've got two historians who've taken it upon themselves to conduct a study of the Queen of Talk through their podcast, which is fantastic, Oprah Demics. We're going to hear all about that podcast featuring the Oprah Winfrey. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, we'll start hour two of the show speaking of the women behind the fabulous podcast Oprah Demics, all about the queen of talk herself, Oprah Winfrey. That's Kelly Carter-Jackson from Wellesley College and Leah Wright-Rigger from Johns Hopkins. Afterwards, we'll check in with activist and Blackstonian editor Jamal Crawford on the state of police reform right here in Boston.
Journalist and organizer Kim Kelly on to talk about her new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Then former Education Secretary Paul Revel here to weigh in on how local schools are weathering this latest COVID wave and how closing schools for COVID for so long ended up hurting the most vulnerable it was intended to help. All that and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. So we all know Oprah Winfrey has had a massive impact on our culture, one of the few people in society who can get by on that single moniker thing. Now, two historians and good friends, I should say, make the case in the new podcast, Oprahdemics, that she's worthy of long-form academic and entertaining study. Host Kelly Carter-Jackson and Leah Wright-Reger join us now. Kelly's an associate professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley. Leah's an associate professor of history at Johns Hopkins. Kelly, Leah, we are thrilled to have you here. Congratulations on a great, great podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as I told Kelly before we went on the air, I'm like going to be fawning for the next 20 minutes because I'm a huge fan of Oprah.
Fawn away, Marjorie.
Of course. And you guys really hit it out of the park. I mean, it's fantastic. So let's start with you, Leah. I already talked to Kelly beforehand. Where did this idea come from?
So it actually came from the mind of Kelly. And so Kelly is on a podcast called This Day in Esoteric Political History. And they did a special. They did an episode on Oprah Winfrey. It's the beef episode where, you know, Oprah takes on the beef industry, but then also Oprah gets sued.
Right.
And one of the things that I think came out of that conversation from, you know, the host of This Day in Esoteric Political History was about Kelly's undying, unending knowledge
and enthusiasm
for all things Oprah. So Kelly reached out to me, another person who has, you know, an unending and lots of enthusiasm for all things Oprah, and was like, hey, I think this could be something big. I think it could be a podcast. And I said, you know what? I think you're right. And part of why I think it works and part of why it works so well is, one, there's a massive archive of all things Oprah, like not even just her show. Her show is 4,500 episodes.
That's amazing.
But, you know, she touches everything. Yeah. She is an institution in and of itself. And it was really surprising to see that there really hasn't been any investigation or analysis of that massive archive or institution. So we decided to just jump right into it.
Yeah, more arguably America's most important influencer before there were even influencers. To give people a taste of your podcast on a similar subject, here are the two of you talking about the significance of Oprah on American life in the late 80s and early 90s. Here it is.
And I think one of the reasons that, you know, we talk about a lot about original Oprah, like the first version, Oprah 1.0, you know, when her show first comes out. Part of the reason that it does so well is that she captures elements of the culture, right? In this case, Black culture, and puts it on television, essentially for the world to see. Now, Kelly and I are not arguing that all of those displays of culture are, you know, great or magnificent. But the point is, she put it out there in a really, I think, powerful way for the world to see. So now people have an afternoon insight into this aspect of Black culture in all of its different dimensions.
So, Kelly, what was your first Oprah experience? When did you have the first connection with Oprah?
We have talked about this before. We don't know. because I have, so I'm born in 82. She comes on in 86. You know, I'm 4. But Oprah was always on in my house. I grew up in the Chicago area. And so in Chicago, you know, Oprah is like the mayor. And so there was never a time in which I was unaware of Oprah Winfrey, if that makes sense. And so, but even more so, I think that in high school, in college, certainly in graduate school, I was paying attention way more to what she was saying than I was when she was just sort of like the soundtrack to my childhood.
How about you, Leah? When was your first Oprah? You don't remember either?
No, I always say that Oprah is ubiquitous. She's omnipresent. She's just always there. I don't remember a time without Oprah. And I think it's very similar to what Kelly was saying. Like, I just grew up in a household where it was either always on, or my classmates, their parents had it on. People, you know, back in the day before DVR, we VCR'd it. You taped it. or sometimes you'd get home just for a very special episode of Oprah Winfrey. I remember in high school, I was wearing a flowery dress and a friend of mine started singing the Oprah Winfrey song because she said my dress reminded her of Oprah. But it was one of those things that, and this friend was not an Oprah watcher, but still knew the theme song by that point. She was everywhere. But the moment that there are two moments I distinctly remember Oprah Winfrey. One is the LA riots or rebellions episode, which was insane. And then there was the episode where it was everyone gets a new car, right? Because mm-hmm. that was just so mm-hmm. different. Like we knew that new cars is something like, you know, you might get on Wheel of Fortune or the Price is Right. That was a big deal. Oprah gave everyone in her audience a new car.
And they were all teachers, weren't they, on that particular
episode? They were all like specially picked the show. And certainly there are, you know, some things like you have to pay taxes on the car or whatever. But
no, she paid the taxes.
She paid the
taxes on all the cars.
She paid the taxes, but then there were taxes on those
on
taxes,
the taxes
that you still
let's stop for a minute here because you mentioned the one on the LA riots after the Rodney King verdict.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, I worked in a tabloid in the Boston Herald. There were almost all men in the newsroom, but guess what was on the TV set, at least one of them, every day mm-hmm. at 4 o'clock, was Oprah Winfrey, where you had this incredible thing about the LA riots and the Rodney King verdict. And it was a big significant thing, I think. I was telling this to Jim, for reporters. I covered a lot of crime when I was a young reporter. And especially in Boston, Irish town, Catholic town, I'm Irish, I'm Catholic, everybody was white in the police department, they were all O'Neill, O'Sullivan, oh this, oh that. And I think there was a lot of, okay, the cops said it, it must be true. The L.A., her segment on the L.A. riots and the Rodney King was huge. Tell us about the two white women in that podcast that were fighting about the verdict, either one of you, Kelly or Leah. Go.
I mean, that was probably one of the best things I've seen on TV, in which this young white woman is basically saying, like, you know, we didn't see the whole tape, that perhaps this was justified. I agree with the outcome. I'm not saying it's right, but we don't know. And the audience is just enraged by her comments because they cannot understand her insensitivity toward this beating. And it's an older white woman that comes to her and basically says, no, 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 girl, you don't understand. Either you're too young or you're too naive, but you don't kick a dog 59 times or 69 times. You don't treat anyone like this. And, you know, the girl's trying to say, I'm educated. I'm graduating college. And it's like, you know nothing.
Well, yeah.
But having them have this altercation, and Oprah sort of calls the woman back and says, no, 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 explain to her, like, why this is a problem. But that conversation between the younger white woman and the older white woman, also the conversation of the former LAPD officer, the black officer,
yes,
who basically says, I quit my job. Mm-hmm. This is racist. I told, you know, Gates, this is racist and I'm not having it. There was a lot in there that packed in 1 hour that was, again, some of the most provocative TV I've ever seen.
So what I always wondered about, and you guys are studying this, is a lot of people dismissed Oprah. And I'm not sure if it's because she was a black woman or a woman. They thought, oh, there was that famous Franzen story about the big hoity-toity mm-hmm. author. He gets to be on her book club. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, he's not going to be on her book club. Was that because a lot of people did not know her impact, not just about, you know, women's issues or clothing or cars, but on social issues. What was it, Leah? Combination?
Well, so first of all, with that Franzen thing, he came around.
He did come around. He came around.
His next book, he was like, oh, I'm happily on
that's
that
right.
list. please. She's not too hoity-toity. So, you know, one of the things I think is worth pointing out is that there have been a number of studies on Oprah that measure her impact on different industries, on the economy, on media. And one of the things that they found, for example, with the book list, with the book club, is that she is more powerful than any media host, if not media outlet, that is out right now, right? Like she has the power to actually shift the sales
in a massive way, global sales of various industries. We call it the Oprah touch.
That's
on
right.
the show.
Mm-hmm.
But on top of that, she is covering topics that really just don't make it onto daytime talk. Or if they do, they make it on in a very specific way. So Kellyanne and I on the show talk about how, you know, Phil Donahue is the only other person who's really doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And he does, but he has a history and a track record of doing this. But Oprah is doing it in a way that is organically connected and authentically connected to a lot of these communities. And she's mm-hmm. putting it on broadcast. So yes, she is doing the lighthearted shows, but she's also doing these kind of deep introspective cultural shows. And one, they're great for ratings because people are tuning in.
Yeah.
But also it's part of Oprah's really MO to touch on topics that have to do with race, with gender, but also that deal with trauma,
mm-hmm.
that deal with
sexual assault.
Yeah. Destigmatizing those areas. And, you know, she did it in a way that we have yet to really acknowledge mm-hmm. properly.
We're mm-hmm. talking to Leah Wright-Rigger and Kelly Carter-Jackson. They're the co-hosts of this fabulous new podcast called Oprah Demics. You know, speaking of the book club, Kelly, when I was mm-hmm. listening to the, I mean, by the way, we should say the format of the show is you pick an episode and you basically do it. I hate the expression deep dive. I can't think of
it's true.
We jump in.
And by the way, don't be put off by the academic thing. There's an academic aspect to this. This is so fun and so real and so smart. It's just great. It's incredible. But the book club thing, when you're mentioning Franz, and one of you said a great line when she had Sarah Palin on, one of you on the podcast said, I don't think Going Rogue, that was Palin's book, is going to be a book club suggestion, which I think was true. Kelly, with you, I remember to this day, before I was listening to your podcast, the cringeworthy first few minutes of Oprah finally having Palin on her show. She didn't have her on her show. I'm sure people remember this because during the election, because she obviously had endorsed Obama the first time she'd ever endorsed a major candidate kind of thing. She thought it was inappropriate. And she brings up the so-called snub in the early part of the Palin interview. You also play the sound. Tell us what your reaction was to that. I thought an un-Oprah-like kind of few minutes at the beginning of that thing.
It was awkward. It was, I mean, we say in the podcast that, you know, when she introduced guests, it's always like, Tom Cruise. Right. It's this big, like, welcome. And she's like, Sarah Palin? You know what I mean? There's no big welcome. And then the first thing she really asks her is about the snub. Like, so did you think I didn't want you to come on? You know, like they're trying to like air out the so-called grievances early on. But it is very, the whole conversation is very delicate. They don't get very deep. They don't ask. She doesn't necessarily ask these hard, tough, I gotcha questions. And it was, I mean, it's interesting. This is what our podcast episode is out today, talking about Oprah and her conversation with Sarah Palin. And I think it's such a historical marker of like where we once were and where we are now. Because I think about, like, you know, we talked about this in the episode too, like the relationships that I had that just exploded after 2008, 2009, that no longer exist because those political divides became so partisan and so entrenched that I don't even think you could have this conversation today. I don't think Oprah would sit down with Sarah Palin again today.
You know, Leah, the amazing part of the first few minutes of that too, and you guys play this sound as well, is that after, when Palin responds to the so-called snub and says, no, I didn't feel snubbed, I was too busy to deal with this, about 30 seconds later, she then says, even though I wasn't thinking about it, here's exactly what I was thinking about it at the time. Meaning, and I'm saying to myself, is that because Palin is not, what, I don't want to be kind, is whatever, or because nobody can resist saying exactly what they're thinking with Oprah. Her ability to draw people out, whether it's Harry and Meghan Markle or Sarah Palin, it's almost like just her presence draws it out of your butt. You know what I mean?
Well, so Oprah really prides herself, and she says this over and over and again, but also her actions show it, that she really prides herself on being empathetic, on being compassionate, on being authentic and vulnerable. And, you know,
I really do think, and Kelly and I have talked a lot about this on the show, I really do think that authenticity, now we might be able to pick it apart, we might say that she's calculating, whatever, but that authenticity is what makes people attracted to Oprah, that she is vulnerable and authentic in a way that we really don't see. So we hear a lot about Oprah's failings from Oprah. Yeah. We hear a lot about her private life, about growing up poor, about growing up, you know, being molested by a family friend, family member, having a child at a very young age. So we hear all of these things, and you couple that also with the fact that everyone knows you have to go on Oprah, right? Like, if you want to tell your story, you have to go on Oprah, and understanding what that means. And so Sarah Palin is not immune to that. She knows that if she wants to make the transition out of politics into this kind of lifestyle, you know, Alaskan wilderness woman, that she is going to have the real, quote unquote, authentic and vulnerable conversation with Oprah Winfrey. And, you know, you hear a lot of trash talking about Oprah Winfrey from people who you know, don't care for her, who may have different politics than she does. And then when that invitation comes, what time do you need me to be there?
Well, speaking of authentic,
should I wear this suit or should
you
want me to wear this suit?
Speaking of authentic, she at some point is going to have to address the snake oil salesman who's running for the U.S. Senate, I assume, from Pennsylvania, and the whole Dr. Oh, let's stay with Dr. Oz. I mean, she's got to address Kelly, the Dr. Oz. I mean, she created this guy.
We are going to address that. That has been the most requested episode. When are you going to talk about Dr. Oz? Kind of Dr. Phil, but we're going to do an episode on the doctors, basically.
Great.
Dr.
Great.
Phil and Dr. Oz, because they really do get their platform from Oprah. And I mean, Dr. Phil is right there doing, when she's being sued by the big beef industry, that's when like her and Dr. Phil make this connection. And he you know, there were Dr. Phil Tuesdays where every Tuesday he was on her show talking about something. But with Dr. Oz, I think he gets even more of a platform because he's a medical doctor. We trust our medical professionals. And what he says on the show, I think, you know, people latched onto that so much. So when he leaves the show and he starts his own show, kind of with, you know, Oprah's blessing and all of this, and then really becomes this sort of Frankenstein. It's hard to grapple with. And so and in some ways, you know, I'm not giving Oprah a pass, but I don't think Oprah could have imagined all the things that Dr. Oz or Phil would have endorsed and embraced. And, you know, I think it should count for something that she has not endorsed him. She hasn't come out and stomped for him. You know, like, there's a lot of things that she's mum about. And she won't
come out and endorse him.
Mm-mm. She hasn't endorsed Marianne Williamson either. So, you know, there's a lot of, I think, strategy about what she says and what she doesn't say.
We're talking to Kelly Carter Jackson and Leah Wright Rigger. The podcast is Oprah Demics, and it's a great podcast. You know, I think she's really missed. I mean, think about this week, what Oprah at 4 o'clock could do about the abortion decision. Yeah. I mean, her ability to bring different sides together and change minds. And, I mean, you mentioned before, the power that she has, or certainly did even more when she was on TV every day. I think that's where a lot of the resentment came from, because she is such a powerful woman. She's a black woman. She's a really powerful black woman. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, there's the other lighter side, that the difference that she made in all of our lives, when you think of things like Spanx, you know? I mean, Spanx changed the world for millions of American women. So she covered the whole thing. She talked a lot about her battles with weight. She talked about the sexual assault stuff.
And WW, which she is the owner of now.
That's right. So, I don't know. I wish she were on every day, but that's not going to happen anymore, is it?
No.
I think Oprah put in her 25 years of daytime talk show. That's more than anybody else that I can think of. You know, all of the Sally Jesse Raphaels and your Jenny Jones and your Ricky Lakes, you know, they had runs, but nothing like she had.
Yeah.
And what I loved is that she went out on top on her own terms. You know, she didn't wait until we were like, enough already. She was like, 25 feels good. I'm out. I mean, she's still out there. It's not like she's gone. Well, she still very much has an influence. We still wait on bated hand for any interview that she has.
Well, the Markle and Harry thing was that not one of the top rated things
huge.
Of the year?
And
it was
produced
huge.
One of the best lines
yes.
ever, right?
Which
what?
Is?
What was?
Were you silent?
Oh.
Or were you silent?
That is true. So, and, Leah, you mentioned – I'm sorry, go ahead, Margaret.
I was just going to say, the other thing is, this is not the subject of your podcast, but her Super Soul Sundays that she does, where she has all mm-hmm. these great leaders from religious groups, like Joan Chittister, the mm-hmm. famous Catholic nun, or, you know, Jack Kornfield, the Buddhist guy that after the Ecstasy of the Laundry, which is one of the great titles of books of all time.
T.D. Jakes.
Yes, and historian John Meacham. That's a really uplifting hour. And, of course, it's on her station, so it's a little bit – well, I guess you can get it almost anywhere. I'm not sure. Do you have to get it on the Oprah station? I'm not sure.
I think it's just on the OWN network.
Yeah.
For
I think you can watch it online, though, shortly thereafter. But anyway, I interrupted you, Jim.
Leah, I want to go back to what you said. You know, Franzen got the phone call. Get the phone call now. You guys touch on this a little bit in your episode on the 50th birthday bash for Oprah. You had Roy Wood Jr. on, and he's musing about what a call from Oprah would be like. Here's a little bit of that conversation.
I live for these big interviews. Mm-hmm. For me, they are must-see TV. I really, really am hoping, I'm just going to put this out in the universe, that she does a sit-down with Will Smith and Chris Rock Ooh. And Jada. I think that would be everything.
I'm not ready for that yet. I'm not ready for that yet.
The people wanted Oprah. I just need to put that out there.
By the way, that was the wrong sound, but it was great sound also. About what we were going to ask you that before you go, so since it came up. I mean, who is not hoping, Leah, that is the future? I mean, and can anybody pull off that twosome or threesome other than Oprah Winfrey?
Nobody else can pull it off. The only person who can pull it off is Oprah Winfrey. I'm just not ready for it yet. And clearly, Will Smith, who is on some spiritual journey in another country right now, and Chris Rock, who is ruminating, right, and going through phases on stage as Dave Chappelle gets beat up by audience members. Is not ready either. And I don't want to see it on the Red Table Talk, which is Jada Pinkett's show. Although we do know that the Red Table Talk really is inspired by the Oprah Winfrey show.
Yeah.
Even if Jada Pinkett doesn't say that, it is obvious. And I think one of the things Kelly and I talk about in the show is about how Oprah goes through phases. And so she, you know, the first phase of her show, Oprah 1.0, is really like, you know, tabloid TV, you know, back and forth. She's interactive with the audience. She's running up and down. And then there's evolved Oprah, right? Oprah 2.0, which is I have an audience, but I'm not in the audience, right? I'm on the stage. I'm not interacting with them in that way. I am their teacher. We are learning in this community. Even the sound to the show changes.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're in Oprah 3.0 now, right? When she ended her show, it didn't mean the end of Oprah Winfrey. It meant I'm moving on to something else. It was the culmination of the institution. So we get the O Network. We get, you know, O Magazine.
Oprah's Next Chapter.
Oprah's Next Chapter. We get all of these different projects from her. And we do still get to see moments where we can see how deeply influential she is for the culture. And I'll point to that Oscar speech she gives around Me Too.
Mm-hmm.
Right, where she says,
"Oh, Golden Globes,
up,
Golden Globes,
right? Oh, Golden Globes."
Mm-hmm.
Let me correct myself. So I'll point to that that speech she gives at the Golden Globes about Me Too, where she says, "Time's up." Right? It cements the work that other people have been doing around Me Too. Right, we know that Oprah doesn't start this. This is really Tarana Burke, but it's Oprah who puts the cap on it.
Yeah,
and says it's over. We're moving into a new phase. So I think she's still doing that work that she's doing on her show.
You know, speaking of it's over, this is over. We only have a minute, but I want to ask you, is anybody, you had any first or second or third or eighth hand feedback from Ms. Winfrey herself on this fabulous podcast? Or look at the look on Leah's face. I wish you could all see her.
I will say this. I mean, we were both shocked and really thrilled to see that the Oprah Daily, which is the sort of new evolved version of the Oprah magazine, said that Oprah Dimmings was one of the top 14 podcasts of 2022.
Oh, that's great.
Congratulations.
So I feel like that's a huge, you know, like stamp of approval to be able to say, like, okay, I don't know if she's listening. I hope you are. I don't know if she's listening. But that makes me feel really good.
Yeah.
Hey, well, besides being best friends, you both have the same birthday. I heard too, May 20th. Happy birthday to you both.
We do have the same birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday.
It's coming up. You were
May
great.
20th, yeah, we both have podcasts. Three kids too.
Yeah,
what's
we
that?
Have
three kids. We both have three kids. Oh. We both had babies in the pandemic.
Oh my God. Oh well, my. I'm very impressed. You can manage all this with the three little kids. But good for you.
Barely.
Well, I tell you,
holding on.
The podcast is such fun, and it's I'm a big podcast listener. You guys really got it going in the podcast. It's great. Thank
good
you
luck.
So much.
Hope is a lot more. Good to see you
for
both
for being with us.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Yes. We've been speaking with Kelly. Yeah, it's been a pleasure for us. We were speaking with Kelly Carter Jackson and Leah Wright Rigueur, host of the Oprah Demics podcast from Radiotopia. Kelly is an associate professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Leah is an associate professor of history at Johns Hopkins, and we thank them both again for coming in. Coming up, it has been almost a year since Boston created an Office of Police Accountability and Transparency. We're going to hear from longtime police reform activist Jamarl Crawford about what progress has been made or not made. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And it's been almost a year since Boston established an Office of Police Accountability and Transparency, but has it been living up to its promise as a police watchdog with real teeth to make reforms? Police reform activist Jamarl Crawford joins us now. He's the editor of the Blackstonian and served on the city's police reform task force that was back in 2020. Jamarl, it's good to see you.
How you doing?
Yeah, great to talk to you again, Jamarl. Thanks for being with us today. So, as Jim said, it's been almost a year. What do you think?
I'm not bowled over. I think that there's a lot of work to be done. And we understand that it was a very strange time. Three mayors, in less than 1 year. So going from Walsh to the Cheney administration and now settling in or beginning to settle in with the Wu administration, there have been some challenges. But I could say, from speaking for myself, certainly expected to see more progress and had hoped that it would instill a little bit more sense of faith in the community.
Well, two things, Jamarl. One, what was the expectation of the task force on which you served as to what this I don't know if they call it OPAT, but that's the acronym, would do, and what has it done in its first X number of months in existence?
One of the things I'll highlight here is that, first of all, we looked at what had happened before, and one of the things that you might remember is the COOP, Community Ombudsman Oversight Panel. And they were a group, very well-intended, a lot of experience on the various incarnations it took over the years. But their hands were somewhat tied. They were only able to sample 10% of a sampling that came to them. And then that only came after being appealed. So they were limited in what they could even look at and investigate.
They didn't have subpoena power either, did they?
They did not have subpoena power either, right. So what we did is to loosen that up, we gave them, first and foremost, the ability to initiate their own investigations. So that means that if you were serving on one of these boards and you see on the 6 o'clock news something egregious, that you can go into work the next day and say, hey, I want to find out about that case. That's what we were trying to do to kind of unstick the wheel. It didn't have to wait for a long bureaucratic process, but that they could self-start their own investigations. And we haven't seen that to the degree that I've, once again, speaking for myself, would have liked to, particularly with some of the cases that we've seen, even in the short time over the past year, or even going back historically, some of the cases that have been pretty egregious.
My sense, in terms of, it's one thing, self-initiation, which I think is really important. I want to return to that in a minute with you, Jamarl Crawford. But in terms of cases that have come to them, the reporting has been there are very few. There are very few that have begun the processing thing. And on one hand, you have the head of the Patrolmen's Association saying, well, that's because we're doing a good job. On the other hand, I would say, as in a non-expert, the vast majority of people don't even know that this thing exists
exactly,
or how to use it. Is that not a fair analysis?
That's exactly it. And this was also something that we discussed ad nauseum during the task force meetings. And that is that when Boston wants something done, you know, you can't see it. I mean, you run into it everywhere. There's billboards. It's on the MBTA buses. You know, all the various departments are pushing it out. You know, and what we need to do is generate the excitement around the ability that citizens have to complain against their police department, the same level of excitement and visibility as, let's say, bike lanes or recycling. it should just be common knowledge, and we should literally see billboards and advertisements. That's what I had liked to see and had hoped, and we had actually discussed that during the task force. And as we were supposed to continue on in an advisory capacity, I hope to see that flesh out a bit more. Once again, due to the transition and COVID and a lot of other things going on, we haven't had the real time to, I think, maximize some of what could have been done. And also people need to understand, too, OPAT, we did such a great name, great job in naming it. It sucked all the oxygen out the room. OPAT is not the end-all be-all of Boston police reform. It is just one of, I think, over 30 different points that we put forth in the recommendations.
All of which were accepted by Walsh. Is that not so?
Not only accepted by Walsh, but promised to be implemented by then acting Mayor Janey, and then also adapted by both people who were running, Anissa Asabi George and Michelle Wu, as campaign promises, and then doubled down on with Michelle Wu also promising to implement. And so that's my goal. That's what I'd like to see. That was what would make me happy and able to sleep better at night.
You know, the Globe reports of these that we mentioned, there weren't very many complaints. There are five complaints that have been looked into that apparently they are briefly identified in the city dashboard. And they're not small things. An assault by a police officer. Another complaint that the cops mistakenly responded to their home multiple times, mistakenly. Another one alleged excessive force in entering a home without a warrant. So these are not small things. But, you know, I got to say, Jamal, I hate to be cynical, but we are a state where not only the police, but the government, the legislature, the governor, we have all these anti-transparency situations that make it very difficult for people to find out what's going on at all. And you say to yourself, we just had Patrick Rose plead guilty to multiple charges of child molestation, kids between 7 and 16, and we still don't know really who knew what about that. And the initial complaints came in back in 1995. So what should we know about Patrick Rose? And are you concerned that we're not going to get too far here?
Well, I'm certainly concerned about the case. I believe that, you know, everything done in darkness will come to light eventually. You know, hopefully it comes in our lifetime, right? But I'd like to see it sooner than later. And there needs to be a thorough investigation, or perhaps even an independent investigation, which is also things that I've brought up during the task force meetings and which we all agreed on, because the Boston Police Department has shown that it has an inability to effectively investigate itself, and it often drags its feet. And to that point, some other more important parts of the task force recommendations dealt exactly with transparency and accountability, as in the release of public records. We know that Boston is famous for that, you know, dragging their feet on the release of public records. And also as well, the dashboard, which you brought up. The dashboard under the task force, when we were discussing its implementation, was supposed to be far more robust than it is. And the way that it has been implemented and rolled out, now it's in, like, I think, seven different places. It was supposed to be all in one. And I think that there's some work to do there to make the dashboard really reflect the open source of information that it was intended to be. I think right now it's a very cumbersome thing. I'm a data guy, and I got lost.
You know, I want to get back to stay on this Patrick Rose thing for a second, because it's an easy one, in my estimation, to do something. For those that don't recall, not only is he a serial sexual predator, but was allowed to be a serial sexual predator because the cops didn't deal with him when he was, quote, found to be likely by social services and the police internal affairs to have molested this 12-year-old, I think it was. So Marty Walsh wouldn't release any of the records. Kim Janey, if I remember correctly, when she did release the internal affairs investigation, released something like 13 out of 100 pages. And I have to say, we brought it up with Mayor Wu the other day, And Marjorie, feel free if you think I'm being unfair. I didn't sense a lot of enthusiasm on her part. Here's a part of what she said when we did a follow-up question. This is Mayor Wu again being asked on our show about the redacted, almost totally redacted, actually, reports on Patrick Gross.
I'll work with our Office of Police Accountability and Transparency. This falls squarely within the purview of that office and what they're looking to do.
And we asked Kevin Hayden, the acting DA, about it the other day. He said he didn't know anything about it. He knew about Rose. But this is an area, it seems to me, Jamarl, where, to get back to your original thought, they don't have to sit there at OPAT and wait for a complaint to come to them. They can take an affirmative look, and they may conclude that Mayor Janey was right, that you couldn't release most of it. You had to keep most of it redacted to protect the identity of the survivors. I find that to be total BS. It seems to me it's a cover so that we don't find out, as Marjorie said, who knew what, who did what, and all those sort of things. And while it's good that were guilty pleas accepted by D.A. Hayden so the survivors don't have to be forced to testify at a trial, it has potential to be the final chapter in one of the most egregious cases of abuse on the part of a Boston police officer ever. Do you sense any enthusiasm on anybody's part to revisit this thing?
I cannot obviously speak for the administration. I know that among activist circles, we certainly thought we were going to get his head on a spike, you know, in the Boston Common, which would be, you know, quite deserving. But unfortunately, once again, what we've talked about for years, you know, the thin blue line of silence and all of the stuff that they do to cover and protect, even in a case like this where somebody does something so despicable for so long. So, of course, we want to protect the victims, and God bless those people and their families who have had to endure this for all these years. And I can only imagine the torment and trauma that it has wreaked in their lives. And I hope and pray that they get healing and justice. And I do not believe, at least for me, that this is justice. I do believe and I understand why people would not want to, you know, pull the scab off of this thing every time, because it is, you know, it is disgusting and it is painful. But to get to the truth, to prevent something like this happening again, we have to look at creative ways. And no one needs to name the victims to understand what happened here. So, you know, redact the victims, unredact the officers who were involved, and find out, however that decision was made, once it was found that it was most likely that he was guilty of committing a lewd act with a child, once that was substantiated by their own internal investigation, then whoever allowed him to continue working, there's a major problem there.
Can I be clear about one thing before we leave Patrick Rose, though? You believe that when OPAT was created, it does have the authority to initiate its own investigation or own follow-up if it chooses to?
As the guy who wrote it, along with another one of the good friends of the show, Attorney Tanisha Sullivan, yes, that was always our intent. And unless there's been some sort of revision or amendment, yes, the OPAT has its own ability to initiate its own investigations, along with the Civilian Review Board and along with IARP or EOP, Internal Affairs Oversight Panel. The three of them would have to come together on a panel in order to initiate a request for a subpoena. But each of them can initiate their own investigations.
We're talking with Boston Police Reform activist Jamarl Crawford. So what is the problem? Is it that people don't know about them? Is it that this is new? Is it that there's some institutional refusal to be more transparent? What's going on?
You know, to give a little bit of a benefit of the doubt here, I think that people are just kind of getting started. You know, the staffing has just now, you know, I believe been completed. I believe there might still be some discussion of some internal, you know, things that might need to be worked out. But I believe that, you know, there is that. I'm going to give folks, you know, a bit of a learning curve, all the transitions and all that. But also, too, what I've seen publicly is that the public will and desire has also waned and gone to other things. Whereas police reform was the hot button issue, much, you know, certainly pre-COVID and much throughout COVID, it kind of waned. And I think that here in Boston, there was a sense of, oh, it's done now. The task force, you know, we did our job so wonderfully that everybody kind of thinks, oh, you know, we're done now. But no, there is much more work to do. And I am hopeful that people will not let let things get slow down, but actually now is the time to push ahead and push forward and push the envelope.
Well, just one other thing, because we wanted to ask you about some other stuff going on, but other cities seem to accomplish things involving the police much faster than we do. We've talked many times about this Boston police officer who was supposedly at the January 6th riot down in Washington, D.C. Other cities have found police officers who were there, and their disciplinary action has been taken. We still haven't gotten to the bottom of that. So is Boston uniquely slow or uniquely locked up or what?
Well, as you know, Boston is champion city, and you know we're number one. Yes, in being slow and not releasing records and all this type of thing. So, you know, in that case too, I don't think it's accidental either. I mean, you know, to be that consistently slow, you have to really be trying. You're like a kid that's not trying to get ready for school because you don't want to go to school. So we talk a lot about accountability and transparency. But when it is right in front of you, I think it intimidates a lot of people. And a lot of people, quite frankly, don't want what they have been preaching. And in a city like Boston, you know, there's a lot of ancillary, you know, stuff going on. And as you know, the Good Old Boys Network is alive and well. And there are layers upon layers of protection. And this is exactly what we're trying to whittle away at so that we can actually get to accountability, transparency, and actual justice. But it shouldn't take that long. I mean, it's not even a question whether or not he was there or not.
That is correct.
That's already evidenced.
That's right. I shouldn't have said allegedly. You're absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm. Right. So now the question is, why did the investigation take so long? There's a trail of email, a trail of social media posts. And not for nothing, too, he's not the only one. He might be the guy that went there. But long before this, there's a track record of Boston police and fire, for that matter, who say and do some of the most egregious things all over social media, whatever, and are never held to account.
So what do you think, Jamal Crawford, about the new police chief? Our colleagues here at GBH did a piece saying, should we have an outsider? Should we have an insider? Should there be a police officer or someone who's not necessarily a police officer but knows how to manage things, who maybe comes from inside Boston, who understands the politics? What do you think?
Well, I've said for a long time, and I got in trouble when Willie Gross was appointed, because I was not among the chorus who were, you know, throwing confetti in the streets. So for me, I never like it when somebody comes really from rank and file. I've been on the force for 30 years. Yeah, because in that 30 years, you've made a lot of allegiances and you've also made a lot of enemies. Right. And now if you are the commissioner, you get the chance, the opportunity to reward your friends and punish those haters. So that type of thing often, you know, makes me a little bit leery. I actually would prefer somebody who's a little bit more administrative. But then also, too, that doesn't always work out for us. Give us the case of Ed Davis there, who's also not my favorite commissioner of ever. So for me, it really is about the quality of the person, the quality of the search, the people who are doing the search. And I'm glad that they did this. I might have done it a little bit differently, but and I might have come out with a different description for what is needed. But I'm optimistic that, you know, whoever the candidates are that we get will then have to go through further community process. And I hope we have a couple of people to pick from. And you know, I'm optimistic in this case, but, you know, my eyes are always open.
You know, I want to return before you go to one thing you said. You mentioned the Good Old Boys Network, which we've talked about a lot here. There's not a good old boy in the mayor's office. And not only is there not a good old boy in the mayor's office, there's a woman who, before she was mayor, was pretty outspoken on these issues. I think in fairness, and you touched on this in the OPAT thing, she was just elected in November. She picked people in January to fill most of these spots, so it's recent. But there, I guess what I would say is, despite all of that, the sense of urgency that was clearly there, and it's not just here, it's in many parts of this country, around police reform, seems to have dissipated big time.
Yeah.
And so, assuming you agree with that and you're nodding, what is it? We don't want another horror show like George Floyd to happen, to have to motivate people to take this seriously. Short of that, what gets people who I actually believe did want something serious to happen in this city Maybe you don't, but you can tell us if you don't. What re-inspires people to take this as seriously as they once did?
Well, it's really what I admonished about at the time it was going on. And what went wrong was after those moments of, you know, anger when that stuff needs to be channeled, what emerged was a bunch of people who were put in a position of leadership and organizing who are not leaders nor organizers, nor even experts on the subject at which they were most often screaming at the moon and sun about. So what happened is we went into this thing of protest, but we were doing protest in the absence of policy. So you had a lot of people who were just screaming and shouting, rah, rah, shish, boom, bah, and that sucked a lot of the oxygen out of the room. So for me, I am no fan of the Black Lives Matter movement, so I would chalk this up to strongly to them and other organizations and organizers of that ilk who captured the moment, captured the lightning in the bottle, and led people in a circle like a dog chasing his tail. And now here we are that the enthusiasm has waned and we're not an inch more forward.
Just to be clear, Jamal, what should Black Lives Matter have done? Should they have been policy?
Oh, no, I wouldn't want those people.
So why are you not a fan?
Because, first of all, I know a deeper history of Black Lives Matter than most do. They are what many people, in my opinion, charlatans. They are not people who were ever in the movement. They are organizers. They popped up out of anywhere. It was never supposed to be a movement. The ladies will tell you themselves it was a hashtag. So this is a viral, what are those things people used to do? A dance mob when everybody gets together in the comments?
Flash mob.
It's a flash mob gone wrong. So I don't, who are the leaders? Are there leaders? Who are the chapters? Who can I call? Who can I contact? So it doesn't count for somebody like me who studied under, to me, real legitimate organizations, movements, and struggles. And I do not count them in that. And for all those people that wasted all that time and that energy, why did we not get anywhere? Because you were following people who were not qualified to lead you anywhere.
Well, let me tell you, unfortunately, we're out of time. We really got to pick up on this in the not too distant future. Because I have to say, I don't have the same take on that you do at all, but we can talk about it. Jamal, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much for your thoughts.
Absolutely. And Jim.
Yeah.
Keep Marjorie's name out your mouth.
Oh, Jamal. Always great to talk to you.
That
Thank
was
you.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Jamal, be well.
Have a good one.
You
Take
too.
Care. Be well.
Okay. We've been speaking with Boston Police Reform activist Jamal Crawford, who's got a great sense of humor. He's brought me some great presents in the past. He served on the city's police reform task force in 2020, and he edits the great publication Blackstonian. Coming up, we're going to hear from journalist and author Kim Kelly on the unsung heroes of the labor movement. She's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan. And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Kim Kelly is a journalist, an organizer, a columnist for Teen Vogue, and author of the new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. She joins us now. Kim, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, great to talk to you. Great to talk to you, Kim, and congratulations on the book. So tell us, what got you onto this? What inspired you?
Well, I mean, as a journalist, I suppose you always want to write a book, right? Like, if the opportunity shows up, you grab it. And I saw this as an opportunity to continue the work I was doing with my column in Teen Vogue and just my general work as a labor journalist in general, right? Like, my focus is and has kind of always been trying to uplift the stories of the most marginalized workers, workers who aren't having their voices heard, whose struggles aren't being amplified. And with this book, I kind of got to do it for like 300 or so pages. And it was a lot of fun and it was a lot of work. And I'm really excited to have it out there for people to read now.
I would say I spent, as Marjorie knows, a lot of my life in the labor movement. I was a union president for years, and I can't tell you how much I learned from your book. It really,
really?
Both embarrassing and impressive. You know, you used to focus a lot on women in the labor movement through the years, and there are two wonderful examples of amazing strength right in our region here. One in Pawtucket 200 years ago, and one in the Lowell Mills. People may know a little about the latter. I'm guessing they don't know much about the Pawtucket situation. Could you put some flesh on those bones, if you would, there, Kim?
Yeah, so it's not interesting. It's so, I'm trying not to curse, unfair that women's contributions to the movement have kind of been minimized over the years, because we were the first to do a whole lot of really important things. Like, for example, in Pawtucket, Rhode Island in 1824, a group of women working in a factory there led the nation's first factory strike. They were out for a week. They're being overworked, underpaid, kind of the classic story that a lot of people could probably relate to now. But in the 1800s, it was even worse. And, you know, it was so early on that they didn't even refer to their action as a strike. They called it a turnout. That terminology came a little bit later. But yeah, they were out for a week. There were over 100 of young women who basically fought back against the mill bosses. And, you know, at one point, I'm not going to say it was one of our girls, someone in the enthusiastic crowd supporting them set fire to one of the mills. You know, they send a little message there. And the mill owners got the message and went back to the negotiating table, and they won. You know, it was a really interesting early example of collective action, of labor organizing, of worker power in this country. And it came from a bunch of young women in Rhode Island.
Well, you point out in the book that the bosses were extending their 12-hour workday to a 14-hour workday. I mean, that's what, 7 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night? Go home, go to bed, and get up again, and come back?
It's wild to think about how it was just accepted at that point that workers would go to work for 12 hours, 14 hours, 16 hours, whether it was in a factory or a coal mine or in the fields. This idea of a weekend, of time off, of time to rest was just totally not part of the equation, except maybe if you're lucky, you got a Sunday off. Like, that has been a major theme of the early labor movement, and even now, of people trying to get a little bit of time to themselves and to work a decent amount of hours and get paid for their efforts.
And remind people about what happened in Lowell, if they've forgotten, where you point out that managers nailed the windows shut so they were all boiling up inside. I didn't realize it was because this was to keep the thread at maximum pliability for the textile. So tell us about Lowell.
So Lowell was, I mean, if you've ever heard the phrase dark satanic mills, Lowell was kind of the ground zero for that, just that situation where, again, and this was common throughout New England in the earlier era of labor. Like, it was young women who are coming in, they're farm girls coming in and trying to get a little bit of independence for the first time, getting their first job. They're really excited. And the bosses saw them as very easily exploitable, thought they'd be a docile workforce that would accept mistreatment without saying boo. And they were wrong, especially in Lowell, where a lot of the factory women, especially led by a woman named Sarah Bagley, who was a really incredible early labor leader, they fought back. They went on strike. They, you know, they were trying to, again, win a lesser workday, less than 16 hours. Hundreds of them went on strike in the, I'm trying to remember the exact date. It's,
I think I've got it in front of me. I'm not sure. Whatever. I don't have it in front of me. Sorry.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's a whole lot of dates in this book too, right? Young women versus the mill bosses. It was a big strike. It got a lot of attention, and it helped set a precedent for strikes to come in the movement in general, and kind of plant this idea of, hey, maybe we shouldn't be working 16-hour days for a couple pennies.
Well, you did talk about in the second chapter, a later strike in 1972, where one of the workers said she wanted to get independence from her husband. I don't want to have to ask him if I can buy a pair of underwear.
The Farrah strikers. That's been an interesting theme too, just throughout history and even in this book, just seeing the way that women were able to find power, like personal power as well as political and economic power in the labor movement. There's an example that I really love from a little later on in the chapter on mining, this 1983 strike in Arizona, the Clifton-Morenci copper mines, where it was a really ugly knockdown drag out fight. And the reason they were able to last and the reason they were able to kind of keep the militancy going was the women and the auxiliary. And most of those women came from like traditional Catholic, Mexican-American households. They weren't, at the beginning of the strike, at the beginning of the movement, they weren't necessarily encouraged to work outside the home or be public. It was a very patriarchal setup. But as the strike went on, these women became so much more kind of in your face and so much more emboldened. They went from, you know, setting up strike kitchens and feeding the strikers to doing that while also going out on the picket lines and getting into fights with the cops and going out on nationwide speaking tours to talk about the plight and what they were dealing with in Arizona. Just the transformative impact that collective power can really have on people that feel like they don't have any of their own is pretty impressive.
We're talking to Kim Kelly. The book is Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. So what happened? I mean, we hear all the time now where such a small percentage of the United States workers are unionized. You still have government unions, but they're really about the only ones that seem to have much power. What happened?
The numbers aren't great, not going to lie to you. I think we're at, 10.3% union density in this country? Yeah, and that's it's been declining for longer than I've been alive, and I'm 34. And there are a lot of reasons for that, whether it's, you know, talking about Reagan, talking about the PACO strike, talking about right to work, talking about all these different legal decisions and laws that were passed that stymie worker organizing and kind of put a damper on the movement. Or, you know, how things happening in the manufacturing industry, the nature of work changing. There's someone smarter than me could probably break it all down way better. But we are at a point, though, where, the numbers are not so good. But we're in a really interesting moment where there's so much more enthusiasm and optimism around the movement than we've seen in a really long time. And I'm really hoping that those numbers do start to change, especially thanks to the fact that we finally have a National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, that seems like it's grown a little bit of a backbone, that it's willing to go after some of these big corporate offenders and stand up for workers and actually ease the path of workers in the U.S. to actually organize and join unions, which is kind of the point.
Yeah, but, you know, on that front about the National Labor Relations Board, Joe Biden candidate talked about changing laws to make them more union friendly. It hasn't happened yet, and he's likely to lose a Democratic majority in the House imminently, so it's probably not going to happen. Despite your perspective on the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, the reality is I interviewed two women who were organizing two Starbucks in Greater Boston the other day, and they talked about the same kind of tactics. Talk about history repeating itself, which is a huge part of your book, by the way, which I think people would find most interesting. The same sort of tactics, captive audience meetings where you are required to go even one-on-one with an employer where he or she tells you how horrible this union is going to be for your life, which can be really intimidating. Firing a worker, because many employers that are large, a la Starbucks or an Amazon, both of which have done it allegedly, the cost of firing and losing in a year when the National Labor Relations Board rules for the workers of the union is a small cost of doing business. If it's going to scare those workers into not organizing, well, then fire them. And when we lose, we'll pay them their back pay and a penalty. So as strong as you perceive compared to recent history, the NLRB to be, without law changes, the deck is still stacked against the average American worker who wants to form a union. Is it not, Kim?
Oh, that's definitely true. And I mean, even having the most quote unquote pro-union president in however long, however they're selling that, it's helped a little bit, like with the NLRB. But like you said, there's so much labor law reform that needs to happen. There's so much on the legislative and federal level that could be done and should be done to actually help working people in this country. That's just not happening. And if I was in charge, it would be, but unfortunately, I am not. So I am taking, and I do tend to be a little bit of a Pollyanna about these things. I have to admit that. But I think that it's kind of, it shows that, you know, the government's not going to save us. The people in charge are not going to make it any easier on us. It's not in their best interest to do so. So all that power and all that progress is going to have to continue coming from the rank and file, from the workers themselves, from people-led movements, whether it's at Starbucks, like you mentioned, where they're dealing with these arcane union-busting tactics that have been around since the Gilded Age, or at Amazon, where workers in Staten Island built up an independent union from scratch and actually won sure, it's the first victory in a very long war, but it's important to celebrate those wins. And I do hope that workers will see this and see not only are these workers taking on these big companies, they're doing it against these aggressive, well-funded anti-union campaigns. They're doing it in under duress, and they're still doing it. They're still trying. A lot of the times they're still winning. I think that's inspiring. I think that's important. It's important for people to see us winning, right? Because like you said, the deck is stacked against us. So whenever workers are able to overcome all those obstacles and notch a win for the working class, that's not nothing. You know, it's a start at the very least.
Well, Kim Kelly, let's talk about that, because the Alabama strike with Amazon did not work, but the New York strike did work. So what was the difference?
I spent a lot of time covering the folks in Alabama, and I'm still interested to see what happens, because their rerun, we still don't know the end results. There's still about 416 challenge ballots. There's still like 21 unfair labor practice charges. That one's going to shake out in the courts, and we'll see, right? Because Amazon has employed kind of the same union busting tactics in both locations, but in Alabama, Bessemer, Alabama, the environment is so much different than Staten Island. There's so many fewer opportunities for folks to find employment that pays as much as Amazon does. Like in a horrible way, they're one of the best games in town, yeah. Which just says how awful the situation is there, right? And there's, you know, the legislator and the politicians, like it's not a, in terms of the people in charge, it is not a pro-labor state. There's not a lot of support there. And something that really impacted the earlier organizing of the campaign there, that was happening in the very beginning of the pandemic. So people couldn't have meetings. People couldn't meet with organizers. That personal touch was kind of impossible. And then Amazon had all the time in the world to hold their captive audience meetings, to send out their messages, to do their propaganda stuff, and to scare people. That's why they got their second election. But one of the things that really differentiates the two, like Staten Island and Bessemer, is the fact that Amazon was able to use RWSU, the union, their presence. They're able to third party them, which is to say they're able to tell workers, oh, these people came down from New York City. They just want your money. They just want to mess around with your life and your job. They don't care about you. And whereas in Staten Island, it was just the workers themselves leading all the organizing and doing all the conversating. It was so much harder for the company to drive a wedge and to sort of hammer home the whatever latent fears people had. And I think it had a big impact. So, I mean, again, to shout out to the NLRB, Jennifer Abruzzo, the general counsel, has indicated that she wants to get rid of captive audience meetings as a tactic. I think that would be a big deal. You know, and I don't want to put too much hope into any government thing, right? But that would have been a big difference, I think, there.
You know, interesting. I think your analysis of what happened in Staten Island is exactly right. They did it independently. They had none of the baggage that, unfortunately, organized labor carries with it with unorganized workers, fairly or unfairly. But when you read the incredible stories about Chris Smalls and the other people who are involved there, they are otherworldly great. And the question really is, can they be replicated in other places? It's very expensive, as you know, and you got to give up your life and you got to beg for money to be able to do the things. You need lawyers, you need organizers. A lot of this was a volunteer effort. One, can it be replicated in your estimation, Kim Kelly? And two, did organized labor learn a lesson from this, that maybe we should stand back a little, provide whatever support we can when the Chris Smalls of the world request it, but let these incredibly industrious, creative, hardworking people do their own thing with us embracing them rather than sort of owning them, for lack of a better expression? What do you think?
I certainly hope so, because that's the exact right lesson to take from all of this. That bottom up is much more effective and much more much better way to do it than top down. And I mean, throughout the history of labor in this country, there have been lots of people who have done it on their own, right? Have built independent movements, independent unions, whether it was, you know, Dorothy Lee Bolden in the 1960s in Atlanta organizing domestic workers with her National Domestic Workers of America organization, or
she worked with Reverend King too, did she not?
Yeah.
So talking about having outside strong community support, whether it's organized labor or faith organizations, she built it, she had it.
Yeah, I think he was like one of her next door neighbors and told her, you know what, if you're fed up, just do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And she did. And now she's she's an icon, very much deservedly so. Or you can also think about the IWW, they've always been the wild card, right? But they've always organized kind of outside the traditional framework. It's always been worker led. It's always been a little more radical. Honestly, Chris Smalls makes me think of an organizer named Ben Fletcher, who worked on the docks here in Philadelphia in the 1910s. Who was another like working class radical black organizer who he basically was able to organize an interracial union on the docks in like the 1910s. And they ran the show for almost a decade. And they did that by embracing this multiracial solidarity and this worker led focus that has been the IWW's bread and butter for well over a century. But I think that people should take this as a lesson, and as people in the labor movement should take this as a lesson, and if they're smart, and some have shown that they are, they will embrace what the Amazon Labor Union has done and show up and offer resources and offer the support and legal infrastructure that they don't have. I mean, the Teamsters have been very vocal about their intent to organize in the Amazon space, and I've seen that, you know, the new president, I think Sean O'Brien, met with Christian Smalls very recently and was making it very clear, like, okay, we have your back. Honestly, that feels like the best way for these more established, kind of maybe bogged down labor organizations to support this new wave of interest.
By the way, Sean is from Local 25, I believe, right here in Boston.
Yeah, he seems
who's
cool.
Now the international president. Yeah,
I'm glad he's in there, and he seems like he gets it, like he's paying attention, and that's what we need from labor leaders in the more established milieu to like see that okay, maybe we don't need to be leading, maybe we need to be kind of following behind, offering support there when you call, but we're not going to impose our agenda or our playbook on anything you're doing, because honestly, maybe y'all have it figured out better than we do. Things change.
Kim Kelly, we only have about 30 seconds left, but I just wondered very quickly before the end, a lot of talk now about employees having more power now because of the pandemic. A lot of them are professional people, computer coders or whatever. But is this a moment, do you think, where some better deals for workers, professional workers and blue collar workers, can come forward?
I hope so, and I believe so. I think that we're in a really exciting time for the labor movement, and I think a lot of people are fired up and inspired in ways that maybe hadn't been over the past decades or years. And there's so much more public support for unions and so much more of a visible presence. The labor movement is kind of cool again, and that is definitely a very good thing. And hopefully my book will help inspire people to look back through history and see themselves in it and realize that, you know, the past belonged to us and so does the future.
Well, the book is Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. The author is Kim Kelly, journalist and columnist for Teen Vogue. And thank you so much for speaking with us. And congratulations.
Thank you, Kim.
On the
really
book.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This is great.
You're very welcome. You. Coming up, our former Education Secretary Paul Revel on Mayor Wu's new plan to offer more early college programs for kids in the Boston public schools and what the impact was of schools closing during COVID, and it wasn't good. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Mardrigue and Jim Browder. Joining us now on Zoom is Paul Revel. Paul's going to talk to us about the uptick in COVID cases in schools, what educators and parents are doing and should be doing. Paul, as you know, is the former Secretary of Education and professor at Massachusetts and professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, is Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, a Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Hello there, Paul.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey, Paul. Great to talk to you. So let's start with Mayor Wu announcing this expansion of early college programs for five high schools in Boston. For example, they'd have expansion would add computer science and engineering programs at the New Mission High School, health science pathways at Brighton High School. This is great.
Hallelujah.
The sound. Should we hear from Mayor Wu for a second?
Oh, yeah, let's play the sound from Mayor Wu.
Here she is announcing this at a press conference yesterday.
Expanding early college across BPS is critical to lowering the cost of a college education. And we see this as an important piece for student debt cancellation and to make sure that our young people are not emerging from the opportunities we're creating in Boston Public Schools to a life of debt that then continues to be a burden.
Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, but I kind of thought this was happening already and that it happens in other schools kind of routinely. Is Boston just behind on this like it is on other things?
Well, let's step back for a moment. First of all, I think this is a terrific announcement and a great development. I think we're, you know, the mayor is shifting attention now onto the comprehensive high schools in Boston. We've had years of discussion about the exam schools, and now, you know, we've got some positive news really amidst the cascade of some negative news over the course of the past couple of months. So very positive development. Yes, it is going on in some school systems wholesale across the system. And yes, it is going on in Boston in selected schools and selected programs. And this is just expanding that, but taking a move in the direction of ultimately making a guarantee to all children in Boston that you'll have a pathway to college and or you'll have a pathway to career. In other words, we're going to guarantee you you'll be prepared to take the next step. And the college community and the business community are stepping up, and we're much evident. I was at that press conference yesterday. I'm very impressed with the turnout and the kind of commitment that was evidenced by people participating.
I don't know if you answered Marjorie's question. I was fumbling with something here for a second. What took so long? I mean, this is one of these things. I'm with Marjorie. Is so obviously a good idea and so obviously necessary. Why was it celebrated yesterday rather than 5 years ago or whatever?
Well, what I was saying is, you know, we're celebrating the expansion of a program. I mean, you know, there's the former principal of Charleston High School was up there with the president of Bunker Hill Community College yesterday talking about how they pioneered this work in Boston 8 years ago.
Okay.
And started early college and started some of these innovation pathways. So it isn't that this is the beginning of something brand new in the school system. It's the expansion. And I think part of an effort to say, you know what we were doing in sort of selected silos for a few kids in a program here and a program there ought to be an entitlement that's available to everybody.
Okay, so I hate to be picking on the Boston Public Schools all the time, but this next story about the Mission Hill School, people may know that there were complaints over many years of bullying, sexual assaults. Nothing was done about it, even though parents were complaining. This is the kind of story that can wind up leading the Tucker Carlson show on Fox News. In this news story by the Globe editorial board, talking about how this is a pilot school emphasizing creativity, social emotional learning, racial justice, while downplaying test scores. But as this report about this school found, in addition to all these problems with sexual abuse and bullying, that they weren't delivering academically. A former teacher recalled how she was initially thrilled to see students learning at their own pace. But at the time, she said, I didn't know that not a single one of them knew how to read. I mean...
Yeah, it's horrifying, really. I mean, if you were a parent in that situation or a student who'd been handicapped now by the failure of the school to provide an adequate education, it's really, really disturbing and has to raise questions about the degree of oversight. I mean, I think it's a great development to have innovation schools and pilot schools and the opportunity for schools to have their own philosophy and approach and strategy to teaching and learning. But it all has to be in service of achieving a set of goals that are important for all students to know and be able to do. And, you know, this school obviously went on for far too long without adequate oversight from multiple administrations in the Boston Public Schools. And now it's a huge embarrassment to the school system. Happily, they've agreed to close the school and prioritize families in that school for placement to other schools in the region. But a long, hard look has got to be taken at quality control and the level of oversight that we give to schools without at the same time rushing to the opposite extreme and saying everything has to be centralized and controlled and run from a downtown office.
You know, Marjorie was focusing on that incredible quote about no one can read and the academic failures. And they should be focused on, but I'll tell you, when she said, you know, it can end up on Tucker Carlson, it actually should be on Anderson Cooper at CNN on this other half of this thing. These crimes are being committed against these kids, and nobody outside the school knows. I had forgotten until I was reading a story this morning, Paul, that there was a $600,000 settlement. What's that?
There was a lawsuit 5 years ago.
Right, in which I think it was six families that settled.
Yeah.
So it isn't like they had the ability to cover it up and keep it private. Obviously, the city knew because they had to pay the damn settlement to begin with. What happened to mandated reporters? If they're not reporting, is that a crime? I'm not even sure. It should be a crime.
Well, no, it is a crime.
So what's going on here? I mean, this is what's going on here?
Well, there's a continuing investigation now. I mean, it's detailed in that report. It's not over now, and they're still going to be looked into. But your Anderson Cooper comment was good because I think that there's also evidence of kind of progressivism run amok at
exactly.
a school. You know, where people have said, okay, you know, we have a special needs student. He happens to be Black. He's committed a number of inappropriate acts with regard to students at the school, but we're not going to do anything to discipline him because we don't want to stigmatize him or put a negative mark on his record. You know, and so instead of dealing with the problem, they look the other way. The problem gets worse. There are more victims, and then it blows up on the entire school system. So I think, you know, this in the same way that the reading problem was mentioned. Okay, let's let everybody do their own thing, proceed at their own pace, and we won't really worry about whether they attain goals. I mean, this is what we do in an environment where we don't measure progress, we don't hold people accountable, we don't have sufficient oversight. So I think it's difficult to imagine how this was allowed to fester for so many years. But thank God they've done a report. The mayor and the superintendent were wise in recommending that the school be closed. But they've got to take a look at, and I think there is work going on in this regard, the kind of oversight they're giving to schools across the Boston Public School System.
We're talking to Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education. He's now at Harvard. So a credible, comprehensive report comes out to say what I think most of us knew, is the remote learning was a failure on so many fronts. And we've discussed pieces of this with you in the past. If you want to talk about the report, it's fine. I don't mean to stop you. But going forward, what lessons do you think people like you in leadership in school systems around the country have learned so that when there's the next crisis, hopefully not too soon, we don't forget that remote equals failure lesson?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things, Jim. I think that, you know, one obvious lesson from the report is, you know, when we have a systemic crisis the way we did with the pandemic, that the results are typically and usually going to fall heaviest on those most vulnerable in our society. And so when we close schools, the people most deeply affected by schools are those most dependent on schools, yeah. You know, for basic learning opportunities, for basic health services, for basic nutritional services and things of this nature. And so that the longer school was closed, you know, the more learning people lost. Now, that was partly a function of factors outside of school. In other words, if you dismiss school and your family has full access to the internet and there is quality instruction going on online, and you can get a quiet room and the support you need to do that work, well, you're going to be okay. Turns out those students said, you know, in this report, they lost about 20% of learning over a normal year. But those who lost 50% or more were the students most likely to be living in poverty and not have the kinds of conditions, whether it's broadband access or computers and the technology or the support and space of a stable household to do the work. And so their learning was even more deeply affected. And now the gaps are wider than they've ever been because this has been going on over two and a half years. And schools really need to focus on working differently with kids as they come back. And we've talked here a number of times about the business of needing to customize individual plans and get an advocate for each child. I mean, the idea that we're going to bring them all back to school and treat them basically all fourth graders the same way, when we know some fourth graders, when they were third graders, had radically different experiences than others in terms of the support and the opportunity to learn. We're going to have to tailor. We're going to have to tutor. We're going to have to expand hours and increase instruction for those who've fallen behind here in order to create that level playing field that we claim to aspire to as a society. We've got a lot of work to do, and I think this points out what the problem is. And I think there are some well-known ways of addressing this problem, but it's going to be a different way of operating than school systems have typically operated, and that's often hard to do.
Okay, Jim's trying to avoid the elephant in the room here because he got the award from the Massachusetts Teachers Association.
I'm going to see how you work this one in, Mark.
As this story points out, it puts a lot of blame on Democrats, points out that high poverty schools in big cities are usually run by Democrats, and they have very powerful teachers' unions, and that the unions were very opposed in many cases to reopening schools sooner. Schools in Republican districts opened the schools much more quickly, and COVID spread no worse in districts that stayed open than districts that stayed closed.
Did they know that at the time, Marjorie? I was for keeping the schools closed, too, because I thought it was too dangerous to have the kids in the classroom. Do you think they intentionally did that?
That was the prevailing view in more liberal, more democratic communities where, I mean, there's a tension in this discussion between protecting the health of children and protecting the education of children. And they're not mutually exclusive propositions. We want kids to be healthy. We want them to be well educated. But some communities got what in retrospect would look like over-concerned with the health protections and thereby close schools longer than in retrospect it looks like they needed to be closed. And other communities were overreacting, at the other end of the political spectrum, were overreacting to measures that were recommended or required in order to ensure public health. So we had, again, as we often do in American public life now, at both extremes going too far in one direction and the people in between getting hurt.
Well, I think it's fair to point out, though, that in the first round of COVID, we heard over and over and over again that children were very unlikely to get the first round. It's changed now, obviously, COVID, and if they did, they were not going to get very sick. I think the concern was not about the children, really. And I get it. Teachers were afraid. I get why teachers would be afraid to go into a classroom with 25 kids or 35 kids, feeling it would be a COVID super spreader. But that was what it was about. It was more about the adults than it was about the children.
Well, you don't know that. I mean, you really don't know that, right?
I don't. Well.
Why no?
Adults were certainly part of the equation. It's no question that the teachers generally and teachers unions in particular were trying to look after the health interests of their members. And so in many of the places that closed schools, there was strong pressure. Take Chicago, for example, which is a celebrated example, or Los Angeles, in which there was very strong push to keep schools closed. And we had that here in Massachusetts. Let's face it. On the other hand, it's a good case where, there aren't strong advocacy organizations for children on the other side of the equation saying, we're about to get hurt. If schools close, we don't have adequate provisions to learn outside of school. So the chips fell where they might. And in general, what usually happened is the disadvantage became further disadvantaged by the way in which we responded to this crisis.
I have to say, I usually try not to do this, but I can't avoid this today. The abject jealousy that Marjorie feels because I won the President's Award from the Massachusetts Teachers Association many years ago, and Marjorie did not, is really It's embarrassing.
It's true. I have a bee in my bonnet about that, Jim, and we're never going to let you forget it.
I don't think you have a bee. I have a whole hive in your bonnet, I believe.
I have a hive. And it's not bees. It's wasps. Actually, I think it might be killer wasps.
Killer hornets.
I mean, she's consistent.
Hey, Paul, though.
She's consistent in reminding the public of this.
On this overreaction kind of thing to the health dangers, and again, I think for the most part, regardless of who there's health they're worried about protecting, I think there was a good faith concern that health was at risk in the classroom. Again, I shared it. I was wrong, but I shared it.
Don't you remember Emily Oster, though, Jim?
I do. We had her on.
October 2020, wrote a piece in The Atlantic. Schools are not super spreaders.
Okay, Marjorie, you want to pick? I have somebody in Nebraska that said the opposite. I mean, Emily Oster is great. Who knew from Emily Oster 2 years ago?
She's a genius. Remember we had her on?
She's fabulous.
She's great.
Okay, let me just make this point if I can.
Who made the point in Nebraska, Jim?
I worry, names and numbers. Because of the fact that we now have learned that those of us who were advocating for remote learning for health reasons were wrong, and we were, that there's going to be an overreaction there too. And I picked this example. It is pretty clear to me, based upon reading the seven counties in Massachusetts, for example, that are now high risk, where there's a recommendation that in public places you wear a mask. A bunch of schools, like here in Cambridge, have recommended masks. I think Northampton actually mandated in the western part of the state. My assessment is the reason why masks aren't being mandated, at least in some communities in this state, is because of fear that was generated because of the overreaction that we just described about shutting down schools. And it's trickling out into almost any measure that would be a mandate, even though obviously with a mask, you can still go to school and still learn. Do you think I'm off base or no, Paul?
No, I think that's one factor. I think another factor is a generally highly sensitive, politicized atmosphere around masks. If you read the announcements that these districts sent out, they bent over backwards to make it clear they were making recommendations, not requirements.
Exactly.
There are very few requirements around now. And they don't want to trigger that whole controversy that's coming to school boards all across the country, this divisiveness. But the other thing that I have to say in response to your earlier comment about remote learning is it's not a given that remote learning is inferior. Remote learning done well can be a positive thing. It can work. I mean, part of the lesson to be taken from this isn't just about school closures. It's about schools and communities didn't actually take the steps necessary to deliver high quality online learning.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you made that correction.
As you said, too, if you were a poor kid who didn't really have a place to do your work, who had a lousy internet connection, who could never get those Chromebooks, we were always hearing about the Chromebooks weren't working very well. If you didn't have your own Apple Mac AirBook or whatever,
do you remember what Shirley Leung, Marjorie, told us she did every day while she's writing her column?
She was working with her kids.
She would sit next to her younger child for 4 hours during class helping him. Most families can't do that.
Well, exactly. And I think that's why if poor kids, once again, as Paul has pointed out, took the brunt of the learning loss.
There's another dimension to it as well that pertains a little bit to the point that you were raising earlier, Marjorie, about adult interest. There wasn't sufficient time made by either districts or unions to do the kind of professional development and to provide the kind of support to teachers that they needed to do high quality teaching over the internet.
You know what I also wondered, Paul, I know everybody thinks this is a terrible idea, so why do I keep pushing it? But I almost thought if you went out at the beginning, the third week of third grade, then you come back at the third week of third grade, everybody just gets another year. I don't know why that seemed like such a ridiculous idea, but I know you've told me it is, and so does everybody else, but
it treats everybody as though their experience in the interim has been the same. So bring them back in the same place.
Yeah.
And, some of those kids who had the Shirleys at home and all kinds of supports and opportunities, they were already midway through fourth grade where they ought to be. And others have fallen back to kind of second grade level. And so we need to do the adaptation necessary to meet each kid where he or she is and give them what they need to get you know, back on track with, relatively speaking, their age cohort.
You know, Paul, we got to go, but I will, as soon as the show's over, I will post on Twitter the photograph of me receiving the President's Award from the Mass Teachers. I have it from a couple of different angles.
Yeah.
So if you go to my Twitter page, at Jim Browdy, maybe 2:30 or 3.
I think
it'll
you should
available.
Frame it as a Christmas present for Marjorie.
Well, what are you talking about, Paul? I've had to look at it now for about 20 years, and I'm sick of looking at it. And you know what else I'm looking at? The standing ovation. I'm sick of hearing about that, too. We really want to get down to the weeds here, Jim.
It was a good day. What can I tell you? Hey, Paul, it's great to see you.
Take this down. Okay,
thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
Paul Revel is the former Secretary of Education and a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, is a collaborative action
so
for
jealous.
Equity and opportunity.
You are.
Well, you know, we got 1 3x5 of Jim crossing the finish line at the New York City Marathon, and the other 3x5 of the standing ovation where he gets the award from the teachers union. And I just can't take it anymore.
Actually,
Jim.
It was a different standing ovation, but that's okay.
Oh, it's a different standing ovation. Yeah. Okay. Coming up, we are opening the text and phone lines on this
whatever
idea. Do you hide your true self from your coworkers, from your bosses, from your colleagues? I mean, clearly, Jim and I are kind of right out here on the line, but other people may not be for a bunch of reasons. We're going to talk to you about that at 877-301-8970. Do you hide your personal life, your private life, if you're gay, if you've got some kind of disability? Do you not want people to really know your true self? 877-301-8970. Text or email at bpr@wgbh.org. That's also 877, of course, the phone number as well. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And we're opening up lines for yet another examination of how we're interacting with each other at work during the pandemic. According to a survey, I'm not convinced it's the most scientifically pure one, but a survey nevertheless, 7 in 10 people, quote, adopt an entirely different personality in the office. Most American workers, they say, keep some part of themselves secret at work and worry about being their real selves, real is their word, in front of their coworkers and bosses. We're opening up the phone lines and text lines at 877-301-8970. Do you feel comfortable being yourself at work, sharing personal details? Do you prefer to keep a wall up at work? It's not just about your personal life. It's about anything. Are you a different person at work? And does your decision about how much you share differ if you're a remote worker? Especially for younger people, we've heard that being remote at a new job can be isolating, hard to feel connected. So we've seen the glimpses of so many of our guests, for example, the real you on Zoom throughout the pandemic. Now that people are, for the most part, coming back, where's the balance for you? Again, texting or calling is 877-301-8970, or you can email us at bprwgbh.org or tweet us at BOS Public Radio. This study, which I was looking at earlier today, Marjorie, there's some things where there's no question it makes sense. They're talking about workers who feel discriminated against, LGBTQ people who feel discriminated against, people of color who feel totally ignored at work. Those are situations where I can't imagine anybody wouldn't say, I really do want to keep myself separate.
Well, you can't hide your color, obviously.
All I get is pain. I thought it'd be more interesting to talk. I mean, that's fine if you want to call about that, about more typical situations. I mean, you and I are not the subjects of discrimination. We are fairly different in this regard. Trust me, people ask me all the time, what is Marjorie really like? What you see on the radio is exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
As I just said, the poster over there, the marathon, the poster over there, the teachers union.
Exactly what she is. I have a problem being as open as you are.
You do? And
I do, yeah.
I think people get you completely, Jim.
What's that?
I think people get you.
Well, I hope they don't. But in any case, what did Tom Brady say once a couple of months ago? 90% of what I say is usually not the truth. That is not me at all. I don't mislead, but I don't expose in the same way you do to coworkers. I just don't do that kind of thing. And by the way, I admire you for it. You think I'm making
it?
What's that?
I have a lot of neuroses, Jim. I'm happy to share them.
But you do share them. That's the point. And I have not the same. So we want to know which category. Are you part of the 70% of workers who, quote, adopt an entirely different personality in the office. If you do, why do you do it? And if you don't, why do you feel free to be like Marjorie, to be exactly who you are at the workplace?
Listen to this texter. Of course I hide my true self. I hide my true self from myself. Why wouldn't I hide it from my coworkers and my boss? One. That is a good one. That's the spirit of the conversation. 877-301-8970. Let's start with Michelle from Boston. Are you hiding your true self, Michelle, or are you the real you?
Hey.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes.
You can. Thank you.
Yes, hello. I love listening to you both. I am a salesperson for home care, and I'm always on the road, and, mm-hmm. The two of you are always on my radio.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. You make my day. You really do. You make it easy while I'm on my travels. But no, I have never hidden who I am in any job, and I've been in so many different types of jobs. And I, you know, even when we're on Zoom calls now and virtually and in person, and I feel like when I do just be myself and open it up, everybody else kind of jumps on board at some point. So I love to see that because so many people are reserved and they don't show their true self.
Yeah.
When I start to really show myself, it's like all of a sudden it's like refreshing when you're on these calls and everybody's trying to be so what they're not. And then the minute I kind of like just show my colors, it's they follow along.
I think that's brilliant, by the way. I totally buy that notion that you basically give everybody permission to be honest and be themselves and not fear sort of exposure. That was great. That was a great first call, and thank you for making it. We really appreciate it.
Well, you know, we talked earlier about this Oprah, this podcast about Oprah, and I'm sure there's some artifice and some strategy in Oprah's career, but that was one of the things that made her popular is that she did share
everything.
Yeah, she did share everything. And there was a realness about her that I think made her really attractive. Texter 5008 says, I am the overshare king. I can't help but be
That's
me.
A good one.
At work, this is to my detriment. I attract unwanted attention and inspire gossip.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I'd prefer not to do it. And by the way, I don't want to tell people, Marjorie, that I graduated Phi Beta Kappa from college. I mean, I could, but really,
you could.
What does that achieve doing that? You know,
that's right. Oh, you got 800 on your SATs. What?
Well, I actually did get 800.
He
on
did
SATs,
get 800 in SATs.
I'm not going to talk about it.
He's not going to talk about it. Absolutely
no,
not.
Exactly not. You know what? But the flip side of what Michelle said is also true, is that she says she opens up and it causes others to open up. But some of us don't open up for the exact same reason flipped, which is you don't want to know that much. And if you do expose yourself, it's an invitation for transparency on steroids by everybody else. What are you laughing about?
Jim says, texter, am I supposed to read these numbers, 0335?
Yeah, you're right. We don't have to.
I don't even read the numbers. Okay. Jim, if you want to hold back a little, we won't hold it against you. We promise. So there you go. The listeners feel like they don't have to know every detail about you, including your 800 on the SATs.
Okay,
your
fine. Both of them. It's okay.
College.
Can I just say one thing here? You know, we just started this text line two Fridays ago.
Yes, we did.
And
it's really
been as much fun as we've had on the show, and we're overwhelmed. You know, it'd be great. I started reading those numbers. It was stupid for me to do that.
Yeah.
If you guys can do what maybe 10% of you do, just the end of your text, even just your first name, or even better, if you say Jim from Cambridge, well, don't say Jim from Cambridge if you're not Jim from Cambridge, but who you are and where you're from, or at least your name, that'd be really nice. So but don't feel compelled, but it'd be nice. 877-301-8970. We're talking about a survey that said 7 in 10 people adopt an entirely different personality in the office. You know, the part that I said I wasn't going to talk about, mm-hmm. or didn't want to talk about, I am going to talk about for a minute.
Your other achievements?
You know,
Jim was a Provincetown leather merchant. That's another one of his big achievements.
In any case, let's go back to the call because I can't take it. Did we just talk to Michelle or is this a different Michelle?
I just talked to Michelle, I think. No, unless it's a different one.
This maybe is different.
Michelle from Boston. Did we just talk to you or are you a different Michelle?
Hi, Michelle.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes,
we can.
Different
Thank
Michelle.
You for calling.
This is a different Michelle.
Okay,
great. We're glad to have you. What's up?
Well, so I want to first start by saying I'm calling from the perspective of a black woman.
Yes. Uh-huh.
One that was born in the Caribbean but grew up in the United States. And so my community and my culture, we're really open and, You know, so for many, many years, I did something that was called code switching.
Mm-hmm.
I would yes. come into work, and yeah. I would be a totally, I would try to make myself as vanilla as possible, just so I can fit in. And so what happened was over the past couple, 2 years probably, and particularly, actually, let me be honest, before that, during the really, really hostile political climate that we had been in, you know, over the past few years, and we started talking more and more about DE&I in the workplace. And then it fast forward to 2020, when we had, you know, the pandemic and all of the info on how, you know, people of color are, you know, the disparities, whether it's health disparities and wealth disparities. So I started, you know, coming in, talking, you know, and sharing more about myself, and including in meetings, I started coming in as myself. And I remember colleagues really being taken aback. It's almost like, and let me just say this. I work in, I work with a lot of psychologists and social workers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say where I work, but I work in that industry.
Yeah.
And so, of course, you know, we're all about boundaries.
Yes.
And so when I started to, you know, I said, we, the majority of the people that we serve in this business are of a diverse background. And if we truly want to meet people where they're at, as we say, it starts with inside. It starts with us, mm-hmm. you know, doing that for each other. And, you know, I was consistent with it, and I brought it every time. I'd raise eyebrows, and I'm so happy to tell you that here we are 2 years later, and my group, my team, and mind you, I was the only Black woman in leadership in the entire state in this particular division.
Wow.
And so I am so happy to say that these amazing coworkers of mine have come to a place where they're anti-racist.
Wow.
Yeah.
And first of all, they didn't think they were racist from the beginning.
No, I get it. Wow.
You know, and so I absolutely am no more code switching. I come as I am.
Michelle, that
was a great
spectacular
story.
Call. And Michelle, there's a movie you might want to see. I had the filmmaker on a couple of years ago. It's called Code Switching. And it's about how two generations of students in the METCO program did that. Code switching.
Yeah.
It's really beautifully put together. But Michelle, yours is a great story, and I'm really glad you chose to share it with us. Thank you so much. Thanks for the call. 877-301-8970. That was pretty good, huh?
That was a great story. I mean, I think code switching, as you point out from that film, it's a very common thing, right? Gabriel says, when I worked for the Catholic Church, I had to hide being gay for fear of being fired, including when I was a seminarian. Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that, you know, I've known in my career who, less now, but certainly when I was younger, that hid being gay. And I think now a lot of people are worried about being trans and being non-binary, too. They're mm-hmm. worried about that at the workplace. Bethany from Attleboro, thank you for calling.
Hi. So basically, my office is my home, and all the different therapists and doctors' offices I have to bring my children to. I'm a special needs mama and a medical mama, medically complex child. And so my children always make fun of me because they say that my demeanor and my voice change dramatically, and I tend to talk very sweetly with certain people. And one of the things I realized, my oldest, who's medically fragile, is 27 years old, is that her life depends upon these people. And unfortunately, if I offend them or if I say something that they might feel that I'm disagreeing with them, that affects my child. So it's something that I've learned to do. I've slowly learned to stand up to the doctors and therapists. But I do know my kids, they die of laughter anytime I get off the phone with anyone because they're like, we want to record you. You should hear your voice.
Yeah.
Hey, Bethany, how do you feel about yourself, or how do you feel when you are able to sort of be yourself and confront these docs and others, as you said a minute ago?
I have a few doctors that we've literally been with over 25 years, and we have fantastic relationships. Uh-huh. But those are the doctors that can give and take. Those are the doctors who can accept criticism.
Yeah.
And those are the doctors that don't have the whole God, God complex. And they're fantastic. And they'll say, you know, you'll put our feet to the fire. And they can put my feet to the fire because keeping my child alive is our job.
Bethany, you sound great. Thanks so much for your call. A couple of texts, by the way. You started
good
this.
Ones.
What's that? Well, you said this person texts and says, I also got an 800 in my SAT combined. I mean, that's fine. I mean, combined is better than nothing. And this person, Will says, I never open up to anyone. People suck. And then,
how about the person, I've lost it, but this person texted before that said, I think it was Tony from Worcester, who said he felt uncomfortable listening to too much personal information from people. Some people really don't like that, right? They don't want to hear about
why?
Your problems.
Why? I can tell you why.
Why don't they want to hear about
it? Well, not only is it can it be uncomfortable, mm-hmm. depending upon how it's delivered to yeah. you, but the expectation in people like me when I listen to that is that I'm supposed to follow suit. If you were open and expose yourself yep. to me, I should be acting similar to you, and that makes me uncomfortable. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, Jim. I understand you completely on that front. What was another one that we just got? Oh, this is the one from somebody from Central Massachusetts. I've lost it, but basically said, being around Bostonians, he has to be really careful about his opinions because he lives in Central Mass, and he has a totally different environment, you know, than here. And I think that could be I could be wrong. It's about politics. Mm-hmm. You know, really stunned. Like even on Cape Cod, which is a much different atmosphere than here, especially Cape Codders year round. You got to be careful about politics.
I'm so glad you brought
now.
That up. Isn't that? It's not even mentioned in the survey. Isn't that obvious? That's why a ton of people in the age of Trump don't
yes.
want to be themselves. I hadn't even
yes.
thought of that. It's
yes.
so obvious
yes.
and hugely important. Yeah.
No, I had someone call me from my college class the other day that was coming to Boston. They were looking for advice on where to live or what to do mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. And we were chatting. And she said, I said something that, you know, I go down to Cape Cod all the time and I'm so worried about climate change. And she said, well, you know, I'm a holy roller. I believe God is going to take care of the climate mm-hmm. and that human being. And I thought, oh, my goodness. And I said, well, we just won't talk about that. But, you know,
say? I'm sorry, I got to return to planet Earth. I see.
Well, I haven't talked to her since then. But it was just when someone says something like that, you just have to agree not to talk about it, I guess. Or you just kind of.
Well, it's sort of like all the people. Remember when the Trump thing was happening? I mean, the famous scene was on SNL when every time anybody brought up Trump, everybody stood up and started singing some Adele song or whatever it was.
Yeah. That was at Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, Thanksgiving dinner.
They got into big fights over Thanksgiving dinner.
I mean, that started a trend. Politics caused a lot of people to shut themselves down.
When you
right?
were kids saying there were things you didn't talk about, politics, sex, money, and religion.
Well, that's a Boston thing. I never heard that expression until I moved here, I think.
Okay. I heard it a lot.
Okay, we're done.
Oh, we're done. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, because I was having really a lot of fun with this. But,
you were?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. Okay, but we are done. And thank you very much for tuning in today.
And by the way, I want to congratulate. I wasn't kind enough. The person who got 800 combined on yep. their SATs, I want you to feel good. Because you exposed, you were transparent. Good for uh-huh. you. Good for you. That's, I mean, it's really good for you.
Yeah, that's what Jim says. Although that's probably true because you did go to a hotshot little school there, Jim Browdy. Maybe. Anyway, we are done. Thank you very much for listening
today,
to us. I really appreciate it. Keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast. Tomorrow, we're going to be joined by former Suffolk County District Attorney Andrew Cabral and the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. Love to talk to him, as well as NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. I can't wait to talk to him about all the neat shows that are on now that we should be watching. Because I think
you're not watching Ozark, obviously, because it's too violent for you.
I am not watching Ozark, even though I love Laura Linney.
She's brilliant in this.
Yeah, it is. It is. I got enough bad news during the day. You know what I mean?
I think so.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Our crew, we'd like to thank them. Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, Rebecca Tauber, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, and Bill Piacitelli is running the board today, and we thank Bill very much. He rescued me in a couple of important fronts today, and we, of course, want to thank our executive producer, Jamie Bologna. What's on TV tonight, Jim?
Well, Sue O'Connell is hosting. I'm off tonight, back next week. She has Joanna Weiss. Remember her?
Oh, yes.
With her band of Milton Moms, which sounds like it's a real band, I think. I'm not sure, but they're on. And then
Wait a minute. A musical band?
I don't know. Just watch the show.
Okay.
But you and I read about.
Yep.
Chloe Maxman and Canyon Woodard. come on to discuss their book, Dirt Road Revival, How to Rebuild Rural Politics and Why Our Future Depends on... Where was the piece on them? In the New York... Where was the piece on
them?
There
was just a great piece somewhere about Democrats not understanding rural America. I forget where I read it.
In any case, watch Sue tonight. I'll be back on Greater Boston next week. I'm Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Thank you again for tuning in. Loved all these text messages. It's really fun.
It's great.
Hope you can tune in tomorrow. Meanwhile, hope you have a great day.